Saturday Live at 9 o'clock. And more immediately after the news, Martha Carney's in Gloucestershire checking out ambitious restoration plans for the Stroudwater Canal to ensure its place as a tourist attraction and wildlife corridor. That's in Open Country in a couple of minutes. BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 21st of March. This is Lisa Costello. Good morning. President Trump has said he's considering winding down the US military campaign in Iran, while also insisting he has no interest in a ceasefire. Overnight, the US Treasury temporarily lifted sanctions on Iranian oil currently at sea, allowing it to be sold to most countries in an attempt to keep global prices down. Our North America correspondent Simi Jalarashow reports.
Allowing the sale of Iranian crude oil already at sea is the latest conflict-related concession from the Trump administration, which is struggling with Iran's tight grip on the Strait of Hormuz. Critics warn the revenue could fund Tehran's war effort, but the White House insists Iran will struggle to access the money. It came as Donald Trump said the U.S. was close to meeting its objectives and may begin winding down its military campaign, claiming Iran's military capabilities had been severely degraded.
Sir Keir Starmer will next week hold an emergency meeting of senior ministers and the Governor of the Bank of England to discuss how to deal with the effect of the Iran war on the UK. Yesterday, the Prime Minister agreed to let the US use British bases to target sites from which Iran is attacking the Strait of Hormuz. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
The disruption to oil and gas supplies from the Persian Gulf is already having a cascading series of impacts in the UK. So next week, ministers and the Bank of England will urgently consider what could be done to help households here. Yesterday, ministers agreed that US aircraft operating from British bases can now strike any sites from which Iran is targeting ships in the Strait of Hormuz. Downing Street argues it is still only allowing defensive actions that protect the UK's interests and allies. The Conservatives accuse Sir Keir of dithering and changing his mind.
Ukrainian and American negotiators are expected to meet in the United States later today for another round of talks on ending the war with Russia. The discussions have been on hold since the US and Israel first launched their attacks on Iran 3 weeks ago. There are mounting calls for the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, to give evidence about what she knows about Jeffrey Epstein. Politicians in the US have repeatedly called for her ex-husband, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, to answer questions about his links to the late sex offender. Her representatives declined to comment. Nornanji reports.
Congressman Suha Subramaniam, a member of the US House Oversight Committee investigating the handling of Epstein's prosecution, told the BBC he now believes Sarah Ferguson had information related to the investigation. The family of the prominent Epstein accuser, Virginia Giuffre, also said they strongly believed the former Duchess should travel to the US to answer questions. New details about Sarah Ferguson's friendship with Epstein emerged in the millions of documents released by the US Department of Justice earlier this year. Being named in the Epstein files is not an indication of wrongdoing. Sarah Ferguson's representatives declined to comment.
A jury in California has found that Elon Musk deliberately misled shareholders in Twitter while he was bidding to buy the company. They concluded he'd been trying to pay less than his original bid. He tweeted that the platform had too many fake accounts and threatened to pull out of the deal. Mr. Musk did eventually buy the firm, renaming it X. New research suggests the famous march by King Harold's troops to the Battle of Hastings in 1066 didn't happen. An academic at the University of East Anglia says the journey was largely undertaken by sea, but Victorian historians misunderstood references to the ships used. Professor Tom Lysence says only a mad general would have sent all his men to Yorkshire from Sussex on foot.
One of the reasons it's so important is that criticism of Harold and the English for their defeats in 1066 has largely rested upon this idea that he rushed down from the north in this reckless, impulsive march without giving his men time to rest. And so Harold's reputation and this debate about why the English lost the Battle of Hastings is entirely wrapped up in this myth of the march.
Now to the weather, here's Simon King.
Lisa, thanks so much indeed. Good morning. It's a rather chilly start once again, particularly around southern areas where we've got a touch of frost this morning. There are also some patches of mist and fog across England and Wales, most extensive around some central and eastern areas, and it may be a little bit slow to clear away through this morning. But just like the last few mornings, we will see that clear. And for most of England and Wales, we're looking at a sunny afternoon, lots of blue skies, just perhaps a bit of low cloud lingering around the Irish Sea coasts, especially around West Wales, into the afternoon. But maximum temperatures getting up to about 11 to 15 degrees. Now, for Northern Ireland and across Scotland, we've got some sunshine around some southern and eastern areas, but towards the north and the west, we've got some thickening cloud here that will gradually work its way a bit further south and eastward through today. It'll stay largely dry, apart from one or two showers, just affecting the Northern Isles into the afternoon. But maximum temperatures for both Scotland and Northern Ireland getting up to about 10 to 14 Celsius.
Thanks, Simon. Now for a look at the morning papers, and the Times leads on Sir Keir Starmer giving the US the green light to carry out strikes from British bases in order to protect the Strait of Hormuz. The paper quotes the government saying the move represents an act of collective self-defence. President Trump is ready to put boots on the ground in Iran, according to the Daily Telegraph. It says the Pentagon has drawn up plans which involve seizing Karg Island and the key oil terminal in the Persian Gulf. A report in the Financial Times suggests the UK's borrowing costs have hit an 18-year high as a result of the war in the Middle East. It says the Chancellor's economic plans risk being torpedoed by the effects of the conflict. The Eye says the UK is facing new tax hikes over what it calls the worst energy shock in history. Survivors of IRA bomb attacks in England have been left devastated by the collapse of their trial against the former Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams, according to the Daily Mail. The paper says the case was pulled at the 11th hour after the claimants found they could be liable to pay Mr Adams £500,000 legal fees. He's always denied involvement in the attacks and says he was never in the IRA. The Daily Express reports on a warning from campaigners for the assisted dying bill, who say they will continue fighting even if the House of Lords blocks the legislation. Eventually, we will win the right to die battle, reads the headline. The paper's front page carries a photo of campaigners holding signs saying, "Let us choose." And that's the news, weather and papers this morning. In half an hour here, rising oil bills and the new rules to protect livestock from dogs are on the agenda for Farming Today this week. But now on Radio 4, it's Open Country, and today Martha Carney is exploring a lost waterway in Gloucestershire.
Well, welcome aboard. Do you want to come on down the steps? Quite steep steps. Watch your back and your head on there, because it's a bit tight.
Steps are quite narrow, aren't they?
Yeah. They are, yes.
I'm on board the Endeavour, a brightly painted boat in red and green on the Stroudwater Canal in Gloucestershire. But actually, you can only go so far before reaching a dead end. That's what's known as the missing mile. The water was filled in when the M5 motorway was built. Now what was once a really busy canal is being restored. I can see just behind us a big industrial building.
Yes, that's Ebbly Mill. That was one of our textile mills, one of the gems of the Strove Valleys, and the wealth of the Strove Valleys was built on the success of the mills. And that indeed is one of the main reasons why the canal was built in the first place. They needed to get coal in, and the easiest way to do that was to build a canal.
Well, let's get the Endeavour underway.
Right. I'll start the engine and we'll head west.
With one of the volunteers for the Cotswold Canals Trust, Mike Smith, who's skipper of the boat today. We're leaving Ebbly Mill behind and just going under a road bridge.
The reasonable amount of wildlife that we see on the canal, and since we've restored this section, we see a lot more than we did when it was derelict for many, many years. We see the occasional kingfisher, although you tend to see a flash of blue rather than actually getting a good view of the bird. So we'll look out for the wildlife as we progress down towards Ryford Locks.
It's funny, when you go out in the canal, you see all the backs of the buildings, don't you?
Yes,
and
you
the
do.
Yards,
yeah.
And everything.
The world looks very different from the canal, and I've lived in this area all of my life, and I'm very familiar with the canal. I remember when I was a child in the 1950s, my grandparents lived across the opposite side of the canal to us, and we used to catch the bus, and about half a mile or so east of where we are at the moment, we get the first set of locks. And when the canal was closed, they diverted a lot of the drainage water, flood water, into the canal instead of into the river, and they turned the locks into weirs. And I remember as a very young child, 5-6 years old, going across the bridge and saying to my mother, "What are those waterfalls, mother?" And she said, "Oh, that's the canal." And my mind, at the childish mind, knew that canals had boats on and knew that boats could not go over the weirs. We knew that that was impossible, and it was quite a few years later before I really began to understand exactly what was going on and why what had been locks had become weirs. As the amount of traffic diminished on the canal, mainly thanks to the arrival of the railways, more and more goods were transferred to the rail, and so the canal saw less and less traffic, so therefore it saw less and less maintenance. And I'm sure that the story I just told you about going over and seeing what I thought were waterfalls, the two weirs, I'm sure that in actual fact, by then the canal was still theoretically still open, because of course it takes an Act of Parliament to close it.
But it got so clogged, didn't it, with reeds and brambles, it became completely overgrown.
Oh yes, yes it did. Some of the sections that we've been through this morning were actually infilled, and every mill that we started from, that was infilled, was filled up with a lot of domestic waste during the 1960s. So we've had to clear all that, and we now have a nice section of canal about 3 or 4 miles long that we can take the boats along.
And this is a lovely stretch just now with the daffodils and the snowdrops.
Oh, it's beautiful, yeah. There's another weeping willow.
Look out for the weeping willow.
Yes, yeah.
We should have ducked for that one.
Yes, I should have warned you.
We've just pulled up by Ryford Lock, double lock, and we're going to tie up for a few moments. Now we've pulled up and the engine's off, you can really hear the bird song. This is a beautiful spot. I can see the kind of yellow of the catkins over there on the other side of the bank. There is a lot of wildlife here, and I hear otters. I'm afraid I haven't seen any, but my producer Emma, you were here not so long ago, and you did, didn't you?
I was lucky enough to see them, and I took some video, Martha, so let me just show you the otters at play in the Stroudwater Canal.
You were really close, weren't there? Two of them playing together.
Just
I wonder if it's a kind of frolicking. I wonder if it's some kind of mating.
It almost looks like it, doesn't it? Because they're kind of jumping and twisting around in the water.
So playful. How lucky were you to be so close?
I don't think I've ever seen an otter in real life before.
And you grew up around here, didn't you?
I grew up around here, yes. And certainly when I was a child, you wouldn't have found otters swimming on the canal. There was barely water in the canal. It was completely overgrown and choked up. You couldn't have taken a boat along it like we are now. And now here we are on a boat and here are the otters playing in the water.
Well, I'm going to keep my eyes peeled, but at least I've seen them on your video. Try not to be too jealous.
OK, Steve, do you want to cast off?
OK, Mark. Board.
Thank you.
I'm off the boat now and I've come to the very start of the missing mile. The noise you can hear is the M5 motorway, and I'm standing on a bridge, Westfield Bridge, that for a really long period of time was just like a ghost bridge in the middle of a field. And to tell me more about all of this is John Newton, who's vice chair of the Cotswold Canals Trust. Explain to me what we're looking at.
So we're looking across the field, Martha, and we are looking towards the motorway. It took them 4 years to build this canal, 1775 to 79. When they built the M5, they actually destroyed a whole mile of canal. So now if we turn around and if we look the other way, we're looking down on the lock chamber, and this was one of the original lock chambers, but when they built the M5 they decided they would fill this in and actually blow up one end of it. So it became a field. So for decades, from the 1960s, this was just a field, but we knew the loch was there. So we started re-excavating this about 2 years ago, and we're rebuilding one end of the loch, the end they blew up.
And so once the canal is restored, I will be able to come in a canal boat all the way along here, under Westfield Bridge, and then towards the motorway. So what are you going to do? That's quite a big
obstacle.
And
under the motorway, in fact.
So that's what's going to happen, is it under the motorway?
Under the motorway. We cannot follow the original line of the canal because there is no way under the motorway there. The only way under the motorway is where the River Frome goes under the motorway. So we're going to have to divert and excavate a new canal and go through under with the river. And we are going to have to build a wall to separate the canal from the river, because the river varies from 6 inches deep to about 3 foot deep, and we need at least 3 foot for the canal. So the canal boats can come in separated from the river, and from there on the canal goes on to Saul Junction on the Gloucester-Sharpness Canal. Once you're on the Gloucester-Sharpness Canal, you can go up to Gloucester and the rest of the whole of the national 2,500 miles of canal network.
And how long has the Stroudwater Canal been cut off from the national canal network?
The canal was formally abandoned in 1954, essentially from then.
It's a major piece of engineering, isn't it, to get this done? How much is it going to cost?
There's nothing cheap about restoring a canal. One phase has already been done. I think that's where you were on the trip boat. Plus, this phase is around £45
million. £45 million. I know you're a big fan of canals, and I can see that it's going to be lovely when it's done. But is it really worth that amount of money?
We think so. We think so. In terms of the canal already restored, there's been inward investment of well over £100 million along the canal with developments.
So, what do you mean by the inward investment?
Developers converting some of the buildings into flats. Ebley, there's a brand new almost village there, where before it was industrial wasteland. So it brings economic benefits, it certainly brings community benefits, well-being benefits. I think we have 250,000 people walking along the towpath every year. And then we've got the nature and environmental improvements with 52 acres of new wetlands and various things I think you're going to be talking about later.
So the £45 million, that's part of a bigger project. It's not just for the missing mile.
No, not at all. That's the total for the 10 miles into Stroud at this end of the canal. Because once this canal was built, 10 years later, they opened the Thames and Severn Canal. And the Thames and Severn Canal went from Stroud up the Cotswold Escarpment, through a two-mile tunnel, Sapperton Tunnel, and on to Letchley, where it joined the Thames. So there was a complete cross-country route from the River Severn to the River Thames.
Take me back to the 18th century, to when this canal was built. What would we have seen from here, standing on Westfield Bridge?
You would have seen a lot of mainly men, I have to say, because everything was dug by hand. Shovel hand is 10 miles in total from the River Severn, because he used to come directly from the River Severn into Stroud to serve the textile mills as much as anything.
That was the big industry, wasn't it?
It was. Stroud has 171 recorded mills, and once steam engines came into being, a lot of the mills changed over to steam from water wheels, and so a prime thing was coal. A lot of that came from the Forest of Dean to power the mills.
Bringing the coal to power the mills.
Yes, and going out was cloth. Stroud was well known for cloth. They still make vases for billiard tables. They still make tennis ball covering. But the seller was Stroud Military Red, which was red uniforms for
the
military.
Tunics. Ah.
The tunics. And they kept the secret of the red very closely guarded because nobody else could make it. And the secret was cochineal beetles from Peru. Hundreds of thousands of cochineal beetles that they ground up to give the red colour.
And to fuel the economy in those days, it was quicker to transport coal, the tunics, everything, by canals rather than road?
Absolutely, because they were muddy tracks in those days, and I think a horse could pull something like 2 or 3 tons, whereas on a canal boat they could bring up 70 to 80 tons at a time.
But then came the railways. The railways put the canals out of business, really, they did. Didn't they? Yeah.
They did.
So when is it all going to be finished? When is the missing mile going to be no longer missing and I can stand on this bridge and see the boats going underneath?
We are aiming for 2029. There's a very good reason for that, because that will be exactly 250 years since this canal was opened in 1779. So we have to open in 2029.
So much of the work here has been done by volunteers, and I've come to meet another couple of them down by the edge of what's going to be the canal again, and I'm with Bridget Mitchell and Matthew Jackson. It's incredible to think that this was all once under a field, Bridget. You've been doing lots of work here, haven't you?
Yes, it was. It was covered over, and we were able to excavate it. And remarkably, a lot of the brickwork is in quite good condition. So we've been pleasantly surprised at that. And the coping stones, which, as you can see, are rather large.
These are huge, aren't they? All the way along, stretching quite a long way, yeah.
Most of those were in the bottom of the canal.
They'd been chucked in, had they, when they filled it all in?
Yes, chucked in. Yes, just shove it all in. So it's been a bit like a jigsaw puzzle, putting them all back and finding the right place for them.
What's your day job, Bridget? Does it involve repointing bricks?
No. I'm retired. It's a skill I've learnt. That's one of the beauties of being a volunteer.
What were you doing before?
I was working in social services.
Very, very different. Well, let me bring in Matthew, another one of the volunteers. What have you been doing in the canal project?
I've largely been involved in repairing the whole flight of locks here. This particular one is the westernmost lock, but there are four others beyond it that we've been working on.
We can see just on the other side of what was once the towpath, there are diggers beginning to work there. So you need heavy machinery, not just volunteer but by hand.
Oh, yeah, we do. We have an entire team that spend most of their time operating the heavy diggers. This particular lock had to be completely emptied out. It was literally full with earth. It all had to be dug out with heavy diggers. There's no way you could have done that by hand.
And just behind you, I can see the really old bricks of, I guess, would that have been a slipway going down to the canal?
Oh, well, that would have been the original towpath, where you can see the cobbled area. You know, that's where the men and the horses would have gone past for the original locks back in the 18th century. I mean, that's one of the fascinating thing. It's a piece of industrial archaeology we're working on. There's a lot of heritage in it, and you know, it's interesting to think, when you're down in the bottom of the lock in particular, that, you know, that's probably a piece of masonry that hasn't been touched for 250 years.
When canals were first built back in the 18th and 19th century, they had a big role to play in the Industrial Revolution. They were for transporting goods, as we've heard, coal and wool. In the 21st century, it's very different. They're there for recreation, for people walking by the towpath, but they're also a really important habitat for wildlife. I've come to the Fromebridge Nature Reserve, right next to the Stroudwater Canal, and I'm meeting Pete Savage from the Gloucestershire Wildlife Trust, who's the canal's project officer. So Pete, just describe to me what we're looking at here.
Yeah, this is a lovely section of the Stroudwater Canal. It's very rural over here, near the village of Whitminster. We've been carrying out restoration measures on this reserve. One of the things we noticed was that the banks of the canal were very heavily damaged from trampling from the cattle. We installed this fencing and cleared some scrub, and what we're finding now is that the banks of the canal are recovering. The lovely riparian, the semi-aquatic vegetation on the edges of the canal, like the rushes and the reeds, are all now growing back because they haven't got that pressure from the cattle.
How did the reserve come about?
Before the delivery of this project, this section of canal restoration, the land was looked at for potential for habitat restoration. So I did think of it as creation from scratch, but actually a lot of the habitats that we're working on, the traditional orchard and the wetland scrapes opposite, they are very historic but have been in decline in recent years. So the Frobenbridge Reserve was identified as an area that was perhaps not great for wildlife, typically very overgrazed, and actually with some expertise from the Wildlife Trust, with some interventions from contractors and volunteers, those interventions can show a real win for wildlife to recreate those very impressive habitats that would have been here many, many years ago.
Yes, yeah, so if we look over to the other side, there's what are called scrapes, aren't they? There's bits of the meadows sort of dug out to form as like shallow ponds.
That's it.
To attract particular kinds of birds?
Yeah. I mean, a bird species I have in mind is curlew, because of the I mean, they're so critically endangered now.
Such a lovely bird.
Incredible
that call
birds,
of
aren't
a curlew.
They? Yeah.
Oh.
And you can hear them on the site from September onwards now. They do come into the scrapes to feed. We've had some green sandpipers, various species of goose. There's usually a flock of gulls around. But as soon as we dug those scrapes, the fields changed. They instantly were attracting wildlife that we hadn't seen on the fields before. So the scrapes have done the world of good.
You've established the reserve around the Stroudwater Canal. Are canals generally a good habitat for wildlife?
They can be an absolutely excellent habitat for wildlife. I think one of the draws for me with the Stroudwater Canal is that it's clay-lined. So I used to picture a canal as a something with a lot of hard engineering, you know, a lot of concrete, mown grass right up to the waterline. You know, that's how I pictured a canal. But this canal looks nothing like that. And you kind of can look at it as a long, thin, linear nature reserve, basically. This is access to nature for all. What we have here with this reserve is a canal running straight through the middle of it. And we are, of course, restoring the canal, but that means we're also restoring the towpath as well. So over there is a fenced-off area where the towpath will be built, and that will be an accessible surface so that wheelchairs, cyclists, mobility scooters will be able to come through the heart of this reserve and enjoy the wildlife.
And what's going on in the field behind us, behind the canal?
This is the kind of pocket of land that we call the species-rich grassland, which we're restoring the grassland to encourage more wildflower species. We've planted some heirloom fruit tree varieties. So we've planted some medlar pears, some quinces, and some mulberry bushes. All of this work that's been carried out on the site has been done with volunteers.
But I can see why they want to come here, because it's really beautiful. The sun's just come out. You can see its reflection glittering on the surface of the canal. It's wonderful here.
This grassland we're in and the orchard next door has a lovely gradient. And if you stand at the top, you get some fantastic views over the wetland site behind us. It's a really special place to be.
Well, I'm going to find out a bit more about the kind of work the volunteers are doing. I'm heading up the field now to a hedge right at the very back. I might be better off with shears doing this.
The clippers are very good for the blackthorn.
Yes.
It's a lot tougher than the bramble. I'm Claire Rosen.
I'm Susie Toy.
We volunteer on this canal project.
Brambles you've been cutting back. It's quite a tough job, isn't it?
It is. Well, we put in this fence to protect the grasslands about, I think it was about a year ago.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the bramble never stops growing. So in order to keep the fence clear so that we can maintain it, we do try and keep the bramble back off the fence. But as you can see, some of the brambles are absolutely enormous.
Well, I'm impressed by you're out in all weathers. It's really windy today, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's stopped raining now, so that's a bonus.
Yes, just for the moment, yeah. No, we always come out. Unless there's an official Met Office warning, we work in all weathers.
And we quite often have coffee and cake halfway through, which helps enormously with morale, doesn't it?
Sugar rush.
Yeah,
certainly some people. I think that's the only reason they come, really.
Yeah.
we're personally invested in this because we can look around and see, look what we've done. Do you remember what it was like 2 years ago? And won't it be great when that bit's finished? Because then we'll get more invertebrates coming and so on. So it's very meaningful.
The other thing is we all learn new skills.
Oh, the learning.
I mean, I've never used a hammer before I came onto this site. Now, not terribly good at it, but, you know, I've helped banging posts and barbed wire.
Yes.
Lots of new skills learnt.
Yeah, and a lot of new skills.
Well, before you earn your coffee and cake, I'm just going to say there's a big bramble patch down there.
Yeah.
That is in need of your clippers, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Back on the Endeavour, and standing on a boat is a really good way of looking at some of the wildlife that we've been hearing about. At the tiller, if that's the right word, is Mark Atkin, who's taken over. And you must enjoy seeing the wildlife from the boat.
Yes, you do. You see a lot. You see things you wouldn't see when you're out on the roads. And you wouldn't know you're in the middle of Stroud, really, on the canal here. You've got the bypass just down there and the old road through just the other side. But you wouldn't know any of that was here when you're on the canal.
We're heading back towards Stroud now. I can see the really tall chimney of Ebbly Mill where we started off earlier this morning. And perhaps the next time I'm back here, I'll be able to travel all the way along the Missing Mile, which will be filled with water. And perhaps one day the dream will be realised of restoring the link between those two great rivers, the River Severn and the River Thames.
Open Country was presented by Martha Carney and the producer was Emma Campbell. We're mining Time's Gone By again on Radio 4 later this morning as Greg Jenner brushes shoulders with banshees and fairies that are anything but Disneyfied. This week's You're Dead to Me is all about medieval Irish folklore and how it was all but destroyed by successive English invasions. That's at 10 o'clock.
BBC Sounds. From hilarious history...
How tall is our King Gilgamesh?
I feel like back then they were just shorter anyway. So I think the lofty height of 5'11".
A giant among men.
To paranormal mystery.
There was a very strong sense of pure distilled evil.
And everything in between.
What are you thinking?
I don't mean generally. I mean on this topic. That's not my business.
BBC Sounds. Packed with personality.
This is BBC Radio 4, where now it's time for Farming Today This Week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. Today, new laws to protect livestock from dog attacks.
Irresponsible dog owners can now be held to account to a much higher level. What we actually need is the police to bare their teeth, quite literally, and get stuck in and prosecute some people to send out that message that people will be held to account now that the law has changed.
As war in the Middle East continues to push up prices, extra help for heating rural homes.
I'm announcing immediate support for vulnerable heating oil customers today, providing £53 million for those households that are most exposed.
But will it be enough?
The government really does need to take a wholesale look at the costs of living and working in today's countryside, and come to some policy decisions across the piece about how best to support rural areas.
And the long-awaited land use framework sparks a shooting row.
Game shooting is additional and complementary to agriculture and is exactly the sort of thing that a land use framework should be promoting, not something it's seeking to restrict.
More on all that later. First, all this week on our sister programme, Farming Today, we've been looking at processing food. It has been much in the news with concerns over ultra-processed foods, but really it covers everything from making cheese, chopping carrots or producing ready meals. And it is big business. Food and drink is Britain's biggest manufacturing sector with an annual turnover of about £148 billion. That's according to the Food and Drink Federation, which represents these businesses. Now, oats are an increasingly attractive crop for farmers because they don't need much in the way of inputs, are good in a rotation, and can be turned into a drink for consumers who want an alternative to dairy. How do you get then from an oat to a drink? Marie Lennon has been to find out with Jonathan Arnold from Grain Merchants Robin Appel Limited.
This is
sort of processing plant. This is where it all happens.
These big steel channels above us, what are they and where do they go?
These are belt and bucket elevators. If the grain's wet, it will go to the dryer. If it's dry and needs cleaning. This is a stone trap.
And inside, I can see the oats jumping around.
Yeah, so here they come.
Throughout the day, the oats are then driven the 30 miles from Wiltshire into Somerset to Frampton's, who make the oat drinks. Andy Rommel is the managing director.
We take delivery of the tanker with the groats in, about 25 tonne. We then pass it through a heat treatment section, and then we take it through a decanter. Now, a decanter is just a big squeeze machine. So the liquid that then comes out makes up 70% of a 1 litre carton. We just use that natural base. You then fill it up with a tiny bit of salt and then a little bit more water. That product then goes into the heat treatment processing, then into the filling packing machines and straight into a carton and then out the other end.
It's one of those products which some people perhaps are moving away from because they think, oh, it's a processed product. You must hear those criticisms.
Absolutely. And I think the misconception is it is not milk. But this is a different functionality. You know, this isn't meant to be a replacement for milk in those kind of senses. It is a standalone product that is a dairy alternative.
Andy Rimmel there. Rural households struggling to pay for heating oil are to get government help with their bills. The war in the Middle East continues to have a massive impact on global supplies of oil, gas and fertiliser. And as we've discussed, that continues to push up prices. Earlier this week, the Prime Minister pledged to help people who've seen their bills soar. Energy prices are capped until the end of June and a planned fuel duty rise in September will be kept under review. Keir Starmer also said the government's going to support rural communities with the cost of heating oil. The money will be delivered via local councils in England. In Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, it's been allocated directly to the devolved governments.
I'm announcing immediate support for vulnerable heating oil customers today, providing £53 million for those households that are most exposed.
Well, Graham Briggs is from the Rural Services Network. He gave Anna his reaction.
Well, I'm sure this initial announcement will make a difference. There's plenty of examples of people being really, really worried about the impact on their heating oils. Any help is going to be of significant benefit, I've no doubt. We all know that the devil lies in the details.
How's it going to work, do you think?
It's certainly not going to be everyone. It is explicitly for vulnerable people, which is also going to include, of course, the less well-off. Certainly in rural areas, there's another aspect to the fuel crisis, of course, which is the impact on fuel and diesel for cars and other vehicles. And that's a huge cost in rural areas where there is little or no public transport, and the car is an essential.
Well, the government can't keep an open chequebook longer term. What happens next?
I honestly think that longer term, the government needs to review the additional costs and circumstances which appertain in rural areas so that we don't continue having to have this question about how long does the checkbook stay open for, treating them as some sort of special expense. These are the costs for people who live and work in our countrysides. They have to be recognised and they're not at the moment.
And so what would you recommend?
I think that what the government is proposing in terms of intending to regulate heating oil is a step in the right direction. It refers to heating oil being different from other sectors in the energy market because it doesn't have the same consumer protections, not regulated by Ofgem. And the government's intention is new consumer protection for heating oil customers. Indeed, the £50 million of targeted financial support, which has been announced, is described as being something to bridge the gap between the, if you like, the regulated sector of the on-gas grid network and the unregulated oil sector. We'll need to see the detail of that, but the commitment to do it and the government's support to the Competition and Markets Authority, who's planning to carry out a more comprehensive examination of the heating oil industry, clearly to be welcomed. Government really does need to take a wholesale look at the costs of living and working in today's countryside, and come to some policy decisions across the piece about how best to support rural areas.
Graham Biggs there from the Rural Services Network. New laws to protect livestock from dog attacks came into force this week. The Dogs Protection of Livestock Act covers England and Wales. Scotland and Northern Ireland have their own legislation. It's the first time the law around livestock worrying has changed since it was introduced more than 70 years ago. The government says livestock numbers have doubled since then and more people are visiting the countryside with their dogs. The changes include new powers for police, the use of DNA testing to identify dogs which attack, and dog owners can now be ordered to pay for the cost of seizing and detaining their dog. There'll also be scope to issue an unlimited fine. Previously, the maximum penalty was £1,000. Well, Phil Latham farms in Cheshire and welcomes these new laws. He told Anna what happened when his calves were attacked in the farmyard.
Over the years, we've had two attacks where we've had large dogs, which we can see from the bite wounds and the claw marks on the sides and flanks of the animals. But we've had two attacks, I think 8 in the first instance and 18 calves last time. So they had significant wounds. One ended up getting shot, but it was a horrific incident that took 5 hours with two vets and three members of staff to try and patch everything up. Huge vet bills, awful amount of stress for the animals and the staff and the vets, who burst into tears. It was pretty horrific.
If the new laws had been in place at the time, would it make any difference?
If you knew that you had an unlimited fine facing you as a dog owner, should your dogs behave in that way, then I think that would give you an incentive not to allow your dogs to roam and to cause such damage. The second thing I would say is that we had DNA swabs of the bite wounds at the time. But there was nothing to compel a dog owner at that time to provide a comparative hair sample. Nothing at all that the police could do. Unless you had an eyewitness at the point of the attack, there really is or was very little anybody could do to pursue any lines of inquiry to identify which were the offending dogs, which seems utterly ridiculous. I think now the fact that dog owners and the police have more investigative powers, that is a profound change to the level of responsibility that dog owners have to face up to.
We're in lambing season now, so will this make a difference to prosecutions or the way that the police can act if we're going to get sheep worrying cases as well?
Well, obviously, I'm a dairy farmer. I've no experience of what it's like to be a sheep farmer with dog attacks during lambing or at any other time, but I think the very fact that irresponsible dog owners can now be held to account to a much higher level, what we actually need is the police to bare their teeth, quite literally, and get stuck in and prosecute some people to send out that message that people will be held to account now that the law has changed.
Phil Latham there. A coherent national vision for how we use our land. That's how the government describes England's land use framework, which was published this week. The framework will, ministers say, be a blueprint for smarter, more informed decisions. They want better planning so land can be used in a multifunctional way for nature, housing, food production, energy generation and biodiversity. To meet those challenges, the government says we need to address the inefficiencies of current land use and that there is a need for change in how some land, largely agricultural land, is used. The Farming Minister, Angela Eagle, spoke to Anna.
Well, it's about creating a map of the UK and saying that we can actually have multi-uses for the land, which benefit both productivity for farmers, nature and biodiversity, and actually engage in processes that mean we have more resilience as a country. So our analysis shows that we can produce the same amounts of food but have a better, more effective use of land.
You're going to have a national soil map. Who decides whether land will be for food production, for instance, or solar or biodiversity? Yeah.
The land use framework is a framework, so it's a tool. The data that is collected is going to be transparently available. So what we're not going to do is say, well, we have decided in secret this is the best place to do whatever it is, have a solar farm or prime agricultural land. What we will do is make the information available, and so people's decisions, as a farmer, you will be able to have a look at the framework and think, well, I could get this kind of extra productivity out of the land, or I could have some sort of different mixes, I could do different things around the borders to help biodiversity. Or if you want to diversify your income as a farmer, you could also, if you've got some land that isn't prime agricultural land, you could maybe have another income by having a solar on it. This framework won't tell anyone to do anything. It will provide information so people can make decisions, all based on the same accepted data.
You seem to be framing this along the lines of helping farmers increase productivity and produce food, and food security is national security.
I mean, the framework itself says that it is our aim to ensure that we produce the same amount of food that we produce now. So we may not be able to use all the land we use now. Some of the land that's used may be more suitable for other things, such as agroforestry, rewetting peatlands. This will not and doesn't have to lead to a reduction in production for food purposes.
You say that some of England's best farm land must be protected from solar panels, for instance. But I would say that some people, especially in areas where there have been a lot of solar panels, might say that we've lost an awful lot of productive land already because of solar panels.
Well, as a percentage of overall land in England, it's still way, way smaller than
golf courses. But that's overall land
in
England, isn't it?
So, I mean, we need to have this framework so that people can see where that is and where the best use of land is and what multipurposes of particular land are. Everybody, including investors, farmers, builders for new housing, people who want to have domestic production of energy so that we're not so connected to issues that might arise in the Middle East, for example, can see where it's best put, where the most efficient and effective place to do all of these different uses is, without compromising our ability to grow food.
The decision-making is really key, isn't it? It's who has the power to decide what happens where. So you are going to have government land use unit.
The land use framework will be that tool that will help everybody go to the source of information so they can make those decisions in a coherent way. It will evolve over time, and the land use unit in DEFRA will make sure it does.
But it's not going to ring fence extremely productive land and say, you are a housing person, sorry, you can't build on here.
The tool is there for everybody to look to see what the potential for that land is.
But it's not telling people what they can and can't do.
The framework isn't, no. But we hope that people will be very sensible and look to see what it says about that particular parcel of land. And obviously, if planning needs to be given and it seems to be a wrong use of land, then that would be an argument, I would have thought, for people who maybe think the wrong use of land is being proposed to argue against it.
The Farming Minister, Angela Eagle. Now, in our original interview with her, we said that 12% of Lincolnshire's farmland had been taken up with solar development. We have since got figures from Lincolnshire County Council, which show that the actual figure is considerably lower, with 1.5% of Lincolnshire's farmed area being turned over to solar farms, much of which, the council says, is best and most versatile land. The council told us it does argue strongly that Lincolnshire is taking more than its fair share of these projects, and that applications are not taking into account the cumulative impact of these schemes. Well, the part of the framework which has grabbed the headlines is its mention of licences for game bird shooting. The framework says that 3.3% of England is managed for grouse shooting and says that while that can be important economically and culturally, it can limit the ability of this land to deliver multiple benefits, including those for nature and climate resilience. So, in what the Countryside Alliance is describing as a full frontal attack on shooting, the government is considering introducing licences. Shoots already have to get a licence if they want to release pheasants or red-legged partridges on some protected land. Tim Bonner is chief executive of the Alliance.
The real reason we're really upset is because there is absolutely no purpose to this. There isn't a problem that needs to be addressed. Game shooting is one of the few growth industries in the countryside. It's carried out at every level by all sorts of people, hugely popular. It happens on farmland, although the government doesn't seem to understand this from its land use framework. And really the last thing that anyone needs at the moment is a long and bitter fight over the licensing and probably then the restriction of an activity which is so popular and so beneficial.
So you do see this as something that would restrict rather than something which would just, if it's a well-run game shoot, be a small hoop to jump through?
No, I'm afraid we don't think that the motivation behind this is to do anything other than reduce, restrict and ultimately prohibit game shooting. There is no logical purpose to doing this otherwise. As I said, there isn't a problem that needs to be addressed. And fundamentally,
well, this did come out in the land use framework. Sorry to interrupt, but this came out in the land use framework and it says that land managed for shooting can limit the ability of this land to deliver multiple benefits, including those for nature and climate resilience. And we have discussed in the past, opponents of shooting say that if you're land managing, for instance, a grouse moor, then it's not much good for many other things which it could be used for.
First of all, I think there is a fundamental misunderstanding, as I said, in the land use framework, because nearly all the land that is shot over is agricultural land, which is used primarily for agriculture. Game shooting is additional and complementary to agriculture and is exactly the sort of thing that a land use framework should be promoting, not something it's seeking to restrict. I mean, it's madness. And there was no mention of this in the draft land use framework, which obviously we and colleagues pored over and responded to. This has come completely out of the blue.
DEFRA has told us that there are no plans to ban game shooting. The government says it will work with the industry, beginning with evidence gathering, and that there will be a consultation.
I'm sure there will be, but the first line is disingenuous in that you cannot license something until you banned it, and that is what the government is proposing.
Tim Bonner there. Well, farmers, environmentalists and countryside groups have been waiting for the land use framework for some time. And to give you a brief flavour of the reaction to it this week, the Tenant Farmers Association said it was long on aspiration and short on the level of granularity that many will have been hoping for, while the Green Alliance described it as a big step forward, which, if used properly, can protect profitable agriculture on productive land and drive investment into activities on less productive land that reduce flooding, mitigate climate change and improve water quality. The president of the National Farmers Union, Tom Bradshaw, told me that farmers will welcome assurances on the importance of food security.
This is a framework. It's not a prescription as to how land should be used in the future. But we need farmers to be able to take the choices as to how their land is best used. I think the plan is that the land use framework will become an interactive map where you'll be able to see what other options there may be for your business and how you can utilise your assets. But making sure that food production is a critical element that continues to be a viable part of farming business is something that we view as being critically important. We do see in there potentially strong protections for the most productive land, which again is something that we believe should be in there to try and maintain that land for food production. So the balance here is going to be very, very important. The detail that's contained within the land use framework will take some working through and then understanding what the longer term consequences are going to be, because clearly some land is going to end up not being used for agriculture. If we are going to meet the commitment to maintaining domestic food production, then we're going to have to see the productivity gains that, you know, we question whether they are viable or not.
There's a lot of talk about targeting the best places for instance, planting trees. Does that mean that farmers in some areas of the country will see bigger changes than others?
I think there is a likelihood that there will be some areas of the country that come under more pressure for land use change. And what we want to see is that this is a genuine choice rather than being forced or compelled to go down those, take those options and make sure that it works with farmers and for farmers, while also protecting the natural landscape and iconic landscapes, which are so important to wider society.
Do you think some farmers will just sigh, think this is just more people telling me what to do with my business and put it in the bin?
There will be some farmers that are looking at this and thinking, well, just how is this relevant to me? And that's clearly going to be a challenge. But I also, at a landscape level, there's going to be, I'm sure, a lot of advice given as to how that land can be best used to try and maximise returns for the farming business. But I don't think anyone sees this as being sort of instrumental in overnight change in the way any farmers move forwards. And the area that we're most focused on is how do we make sure we have a resilient supply of food? It's never been more important than when we look around the world at the moment and see all the geopolitical instability. We know that climate change is having an impact. And making sure that the UK has a resilient supply of food is in 70 million people's interests. And that's what we'll be focused on over the coming weeks and months.
Tom Bradshaw there from the NFU. Dustin Benton, formerly from the Green Alliance, now Managing Director of Sustainability at Forefront Advisors, which provides public affairs insights to companies, told me he welcomes the framework.
It's a big step in the right direction because it is finally making explicit what DEFRA wants from land and helping farmers to understand what future food security risks they face, particularly from climate and nature loss. So I would say I'm pretty optimistic about it.
It does see using land for multiple things as being really important. Is that perhaps as easy as the framework suggests it might be? Because some of the land use change is sort of easily doable in a sense, things like using cover crops or planting field margins. But it also talks about changing the use of 9% of the country's farmed land to peat restoration, woodland creation and so on. And that could be a lot harder.
I don't think it's technically difficult. I think the thing that's missing is that there hasn't been a business model for farmers and landowners to do that. I actually think that it could be quite a lot more than 9% from an economic perspective, i.e. what would make the most money and deliver the most public good for the use of the land. But aside from the percentages, I think the main challenge to that sort of change, again, it's not technical. It's a combination of money and pride. On the money front, the government needs to support land use change so that there is a viable business opportunity out of that. I have been a government analyst, including at DEFRA, and I can tell you there is enough public money available to make that happen, especially if you can bring in payments from the carbon market and potentially nature markets.
Although those have been talked about for a long time and they've never quite managed to become a reality for most.
Yeah, it's been very slow going. I completely agree. What we need is some money from carbon removals, and we also need to deploy the money that's available for nature restoration from the private sector a bit more efficiently. That bit is complicated. I completely agree. But if you stack up the numbers, it ought to be much more profitable, especially in the uplands, to farm mostly carbon and a little bit of livestock compared to today. The thing that I'm optimistic about the land use framework with is that I can see many ways in which farmers, landscapes and local communities are far better off through significant land use change than by trying to hold things as they are today.
Dustin Benton. And that's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Rebecca Rooney. And Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4, and now Simon King's here with all the latest weather. Simon.
Lisa, thank you so much indeed. Good morning. For many of us, waking up actually across England and Wales, we've got a beautiful sunrise this morning, made even more atmospheric with some shallow mist and fog out there as well. Now, for some parts, that fog could be a little bit slow to clear away, but we're looking at a lot of sunshine for most of us again today. Temperatures, though, not quite as high as they've been over the last few days. Each four nation of the UK has recorded the warmest day of the year so far. Yesterday got to 20.2 degrees in Fife Castle in Scotland. Now then, for southwest England and Wales, the patches of mist and fog were clear and we're looking at lots of blue skies and sunshine. Although around the Irish Sea coasts, particularly in West Wales, there may be some low cloud just lapping on shore from time to time, but maximum temperatures getting up to about 11 to 15 degrees. In southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, it's pretty chilly out there this morning. We've got a touch of frost and again some mist and fog patches this morning. Those could be a little bit slow to clear away from some areas, but otherwise a lot of sunshine expected through today with highs of 11 to 15 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, the fog perhaps a little bit more extensive here, quite patchy, so it could be a little bit hazardous on the roads. You'll be driving through some clear skies and then you're going into that fog and then out and in and again. So just watch out for that. It will be a little bit slow to clear, especially from the Vale of York. But for most of us, there'll be some sunshine, particularly this afternoon. Maximum temperatures 11 to 15 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland, it might start off a little bit bright towards southern and eastern areas, but we've got some thicker cloud approaching into the northwest, making the sunshine turn hazy, highs of 11 to 13. And for Scotland, well, southern, eastern and central areas of Scotland, after a chilly start, we should have a good deal of sunshine today. Further north and west, though, it will be cloudier and there could be some showers around the Northern Isles later, maximum temperatures getting up to about 10 to 14 Celsius.
Thanks, Simon. The Today programme with Nick Robinson and Henry Zeffman is next, but before that, a look to tomorrow when we take a dramatic musical journey.
Story of America on BBC Radio 4.
In New Orleans, we were deeply proud of being Creole. We enjoyed the fact that it set us apart. Rambling
man. Walter White's seminal novel.
Did we make the right decision coming here?
About Black America at the start of the 20th century.
So what, we just have to take it?
No, we look deep inside ourselves.
Flight, starring Harmony Rose Bremner.
I began to see and understand the deep spirituality which lay at the heart of my people.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Starts tomorrow at 3.
On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday the 21st of March. This is Today with Henry Zeffman and Nick Robinson.
The headlines this morning. President Trump has said the US is considering winding down its military campaign in Iran, claiming it is getting close to meeting its objectives. Sir Keir Starmer will hold discussions with senior ministers to discuss how to help households with the surging cost of energy. And Ukrainian and American officials are to restart talks on ending the war with Russia.
Also in today's programme, how is Australia's teenage social media ban working out?
None of my accounts got banned, which was a bit anticlimactic.
I got kicked off social media. I was kind of hoping that it would allow me to be more productive. However, I've found that I've just found other ways to procrastinate.
As ministers here consider whether to have our own ban, we'll hear from the head of Mumsnet. We remember Dame Jenny Murray, one of the defining voices of Radio 4, and hear Harriet Harman's tribute to the presenter she called the broadcasting wing of the women's movement. And after 8 o'clock, the iconic voice of Alan Bennett talking about his new diaries, covering Brexit, the pandemic and the late Queen, and why he'll never give up writing.
Well, I don't see why I should stop. It's all I've got.
I'm Simon Mundy with your Saturday Sport as Harry Maguire experiences a mixed day, recalled to the England squad in the morning and sent off later during Manchester United 2-2 draw with Bournemouth. Plus, we are going to be talking to Barry Cowan as Jack Draper is served off the court at the Miami Masters.
That is all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Lisa Costello.
President Trump says he's considering winding down the US military campaign in Iran while also insisting he has no interest in a ceasefire. The mixed messages from the president come as the BBC's American partner CBS reports that US military officials are making preparations for the possible deployment of ground troops in Iran. Overnight, the US Treasury temporarily lifted sanctions on Iranian oil currently at sea, allowing it to be sold to most countries in an attempt to keep global prices down. Our North America correspondent Simi Jalarasho reports.
Allowing the sale of Iranian crude oil already at sea is the latest conflict-related concession from the Trump administration, which is struggling with Iran's tight grip on the Strait of Hormuz. Critics warn the revenue could fund Tehran's war effort, but the White House insists Iran will struggle to access the money, It came as Donald Trump said the US was close to meeting its objectives and may begin winding down its military campaign, claiming Iran's military capabilities had been severely degraded. He had earlier said he did not want a ceasefire. Mr. Trump went on to say the Strait of Hormuz would have to be guarded by other nations which use it, again criticizing his allies for not joining the effort, calling NATO members cowards and the UK too slow.
Sir Keir Starmer will next week hold an emergency meeting of senior ministers and the Governor of the Bank of England to discuss how to deal with the effects of the war on the UK. Yesterday, the Prime Minister agreed to let the US use British bases to target sites from which Iran is attacking the Strait of Hormuz. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
The disruption to oil and gas supplies from the Persian Gulf is already having a cascading series of impacts in the UK. So next week, ministers and the Bank of England will urgently consider what could be done to help households here. Yesterday, Downing Street described Iran's attacks on shipping as reckless. Ministers agreed that US aircraft operating from British bases can now strike any sites from which Iran is targeting ships in the Strait of Hormuz. Downing Street argues it is still only allowing defensive actions that protect the UK's interests and allies. Donald Trump was not impressed, saying the UK should have acted a lot faster. Iran's foreign minister posted on X that Sir Keir Starmer was putting British lives in danger by allowing UK bases to be used for what he called aggression against Iran, adding Iran would exercise its right to self-defence. The Conservatives accused Sir Keir of dithering and changing his mind, while the Liberal Democrats said they feared the UK was being dragged into a war with no obvious end.
The Israeli military has launched a series of strikes on the Lebanese capital, Beirut, overnight against what it said were Hezbollah targets. Lebanese state media has also reported attacks in the south of the country, close to the border with Israel, and said one person has been killed. Ukrainian and American negotiators are expected to meet in the United States later today for another round of talks on ending the war with Russia. The discussions have been on hold since the US and Israel first launched their attacks on Iran 3 weeks ago. From Kyiv, here's Vitaly Shevchenko.
The Iran war has not just overshadowed Ukraine, it has also affected it. President Zelensky wants his negotiators to discuss the recent easing of American sanctions on Russian oil, implemented by Washington to help keep down global energy prices. Ukraine is also offering its drone expertise and technology, which could be useful in fighting and defending against Iran. Also on the agenda is setting up another trilateral meeting involving Russia, as well as efforts to smooth over the rocky relationship between Volodymyr Zelensky and Donald Trump, who has accused the Ukrainian leader of being the main obstacle to peace. So far, all the rounds of talks spearheaded and mediated by the US have failed to stop the fighting in Ukraine or change Russia's demands, and there is little hope for a breakthrough now.
More than 5,700 people have now been vaccinated against meningitis after an outbreak of the infection in Kent. Another clinic offering the jab will open today. At least 29 cases have been identified. There are mounting calls for the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, to give evidence about what she knows about Jeffrey Epstein. Politicians in the US have repeatedly called for her ex-husband, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, to answer questions about his links to the late American financier and sex offender. Her representatives declined to comment. Our royal correspondent, Noor Nanji, reports.
Sarah Ferguson has not been seen publicly for months. Meanwhile, pressure is growing in the US for the former Duchess to give evidence on Jeffrey Epstein. Congressman Suha Subramaniam, a member of the US House Oversight Committee investigating the handling of his prosecution, told the BBC he now believes she had information related to the investigation. While the Democratic Congresswoman Melanie Stansbury urged anyone with information of wrongdoing by Epstein to cooperate in order to ensure justice for survivors. The family of the prominent Epstein accuser, Virginia Giuffre, also said they strongly believe Sarah Ferguson should travel to the US to answer questions. New details about Sarah Ferguson's friendship with Epstein emerged in the millions of documents released by the US Department of Justice earlier this year. Being named in the Epstein files is not an indication of wrongdoing. Sarah Ferguson's representatives declined to comment.
11 people have been killed and nearly 60 injured in a massive fire at a car parts factory in the South Korean city of Daejeon. Video footage shows huge flames and thick smoke billowing out of the building. A jury in the US has found that the world's richest man, Elon Musk, misled shareholders when buying Twitter in 2022. Mr. Musk was accused of falsely claiming the site underreported how many bot accounts were active on the platform in an attempt to drive down the price. Our North America tech correspondent Lily Jamali reports.
The 9-person jury found Mr. Musk tried to drive down the share price of Twitter, now known as X, as he was bidding to buy it. Shareholders suing claimed he wanted to either renegotiate the $44 billion deal to acquire the platform or back out. Jurors took almost 4 days to reach their conclusion that he misled investors who sold their shares following posts and comments Mr. Musk made as the deal was nearing completion. But the jury stopped short of finding that his commentary was part of a scheme to defraud shareholders. Their lawyers said Mr. Musk may end up paying their clients the equivalent of $2.5 billion.
More than £30 million has been raised for Comic Relief. Stars such as Idris Elba, Greg James and Anna Friel featured in last night's three-hour Red Nose Day programme on BBC One. Nick Johnson reports.
Catherine Tate's belligerent Nan character kicked off the BBC One broadcast with a rendition of Queen's Don't Stop Me Now, alongside an assembly of dancers dressed as grandmas. The fundraiser, hosted by Davina McCall, also included a parody of The Traitors, featuring the likes of Alison Steadman, Scott Mills and Anna Friel, who played host Claudia Winkleman.
They're solving that anagram releases a giant wooden horse called Jeff.
The Red Nose Day broadcast followed Radio 1 presenter Greg James completing a 630-mile tandem cycling challenge, which raised £4 million.
I'm overjoyed with how much money we raised with this thing and how joyful we managed to make the tandem adventure.
The funds raised will support projects that provide access to food and shelter for people facing hardship in the UK and around the world.
Nick Johnson reporting.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 7:09. Time for us to have a look at what is in the newspapers this morning. And it won't surprise you to hear that on the front pages, it is mostly still Iran. The Times leads on the Prime Minister's decision yesterday to allow the US to use British bases to carry out strikes, still being described as defensive strikes, in order to protect the Strait of Hormuz. And it has that beside a photo of a member of the Iranian community in London celebrating Persian New Year. The Guardian suggests that this might well not have assuaged President Trump's concerns about the UK. He has called the UK and other NATO countries cowards.
John McDonnell's going to be on the programme later today, a leading Labour figure, of course, criticising that decision of Britain to extend the rules allowing the use of US bases. Others pick up, though, on more of what's being said behind the scenes. Trump ready to put boots on ground is the headline in the Daily Telegraph. This is stories first produced by CBS News. The Telegraph then put it to the White House press secretary at a briefing, saying it's the job of the Pentagon, she said, to make preparations in order to give the commander-in-chief maximum optionality. In other papers, the angle that is being pursued is the impact on the global economy. The FT's editorial says the Iran conflict will scar the global economy. On the front page of the I, it has got the news that the UK is facing, sorry to tell you this on a Saturday morning, new tax hikes over, quotes, worst energy shock in history. Those the words of the boss of the International Energy Agency.
And in The Guardian, a report on the super important Parisian mayoral contest. It says it will come down to a few thousand votes and that the crucial electoral battleground is dog owners. The two candidates in the runoff, Emmanuel Gregoire and Rashida Darty, are competing to win over pet owners. Rashida Darty is talking about hosting doggy drinks and shared spaces so people can bring their pets along freely. And Emmanuel Gregoire, who's the left-wing candidate, has promised more outdoor spaces and subsidised vet visits, as well as allowing dogs on all public transport. Lovely photo, too, of Emmanuel Macron with his dog Nemo.
How long until that comes to our politics here? Looking out from many front pages is someone who I don't doubt would have had a wry comment to make about that. Peering over her glasses in many of these photographs is Jenny Murray, Dame Jenny Murray, the Woman's Hour presenter for 33 years, who died yesterday at the age of 75. There are many warm tributes to her in the papers. Just reading from The Telegraph, it says, humorous yet headmistressy, Jenny Murray was capable of switching from razor-sharp interrogation to flirtatious whimsicality, and was equally at home presenting features on female genital mutilation as on home furnishing. It goes on to say she had a hypnotist's ability to make people forget that there was a wider audience listening in to their cosy chat. First rule of radio: talk to one person, don't talk to millions. And so many of us learn so much from Jenny Murray's style of broadcasting.
It's 13 minutes past seven.
What exactly did he mean by that? As this war goes on and its global impact widens and deepens, it becomes ever more important to try to make sense of the latest utterance by President Trump. Last night he declared that the US was considering winding down its war with Iran as it was getting, quote, very close to meeting its objectives. At the same time, CBS News reported, as we were just saying there, that serious consideration was being given to the use of ground troops. Trying to make sense of it all for us is our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. They used to talk about Kremlinology. Lise, we're now having to do Trumpology, aren't we?
Yes, well, Nick, it's always very hard to know exactly what's happening when a war is unleashed. But as you're emphasizing, it's been doubly difficult in this war because of, to use the expression, the mixed messaging of President Trump. Still, you should also point out, though, that messaging is also one of the weapons of war. And so there may be a method in this madness about how he keeps saying very, very different things. Remember, just a week ago, he also said that the war would be over very soon. And so everyone who's desperately hoping for this war to end jumps on it. And then last night, there was a phrase which he hadn't used before, winding down. And on his Truth Social platform, he actually went into quite a bit of detail for a short post listing that he said, we're very close to meeting our military objectives. He went through ballistic missiles, the Navy, the Air Force, which, of course, he always says that they're decimated, they're destroyed. He also said that they were able to protect Gulf allies. But there was another point he made, which I think will watch with interest here in Britain. Britain, who has just now given President Trump the use of bases to launch, for the U.S. to launch attacks on Iran in protecting the Strait of Hormuz, a decision which was long in the making. And now President Trump says, well, I'm not really interested in the Strait of Hormuz. Others will take care of that. And he says, all they're doing is clogging up the strait, and it would be an easy military operation to fix that. And of course, it's not a simple or easy military operation at all. So
we're going to be reflecting on that with General Sir Richard Barons at 8:10. Lise, there isn't such ambiguity, is there, in the comments of Israel and Iran? You don't need to interpret them. The war goes on for them.
President Trump mentioned nothing about regime change in that comment. He didn't even talk about weakening the regime. And there's always been this question as to whether that is one of the top objectives for President Trump, whether he wants change in the regime, he'll find someone to work with, or regime change. But there's never been, as you say, that ambiguity for Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel. When he spoke a day before, he too said that Iran has never been so weak. But he also talked about a regime change, as he always does. But he had this, again, intriguing comments people were trying to make sense of. He mentioned you can't do, as been said on this program so many times, you can't do that kind of change from the air. There has to be a ground component, as he says it. And then he teased a bit. He goes, there's many possibilities for this ground component, and I'm not going to tell you about it. We do know that they are assassinating one top leader after another. They're attacking the paramilitary forces at ground level. And they do have quite an extraordinary intelligence operation on the ground. And there's been a lot of discussion in recent days about whether the goals of President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu are diverging. They say they're in lockstep. But at some point, President Trump may decide the war is over, declare victory. Prime Minister Netanyahu will have to go along with it. But the big question, of course, is, will Iran be ready to say the war is over?
Lise Doucette, thank you.
At 17 minutes past seven, here in the UK, the Prime Minister will convene an emergency meeting next week to discuss measures to deal with the impact of the war, especially on the cost of living. Well, here to talk us through that in the studio is Jack Fenwick, the BBC's political correspondent. Jack, who's going to this meeting and what does that tell us?
So this is a meeting of the government's COBRA committee, the group that convenes when discussing how to respond to emergencies. We can expect the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, the Energy Secretary, other senior ministers. Now, there's an immediate question around the price of petrol and diesel. The RSE has said we can expect that to go up over the next week. There's also concern within government about what happens to household bills when the energy price cap runs out in July. Now, ministers are considering how generous any support they give could be, but no doubt they will remember that when the government stepped in to help households after Russia invaded Ukraine, the bill ended up being eye-watering. Also at this meeting will be the Governor of the Bank of England. He has been in regular contact with the Chancellor in recent weeks to discuss whether economic shocks could have an impact on interest rates, for example. There have been reports in recent days of mortgages being withdrawn by banks, so no doubt that will also be on the agenda.
So that's the economics. The geopolitics and the diplomacy of this is that the Prime Minister has now agreed to let the US carry out strikes from British bases to protect the Strait of Hormuz. The Lib Dems, the Greens, I think some Labour MPs want a parliamentary vote on that. Is that possible?
So, as you say, the Lib Dems say that the UK is being drawn further down Trump's slippery slope. The Green Party say it's another worrying escalation, and they want a vote in Parliament on the terms of this deal between the UK and the US about American forces and how they can use British bases. It feels unlikely that we're going there because the government say actually the principles haven't changed despite this change in position on what exactly the Americans can use the bases for. They say this is still about defensive operations and that they're going to stick to that line.
Jack Fenwick, thank you. And we'll hear from John McDonnell, who's a Labour MP who wants there to be a parliamentary vote, at 10 past eight.
It's now 19 minutes past seven. The long, long battle over whether to legalise assisted dying continues. Supporters of a proposed change to the law in England and Wales gathered outside Parliament yesterday. Inside, members of the House of Lords spent another day poring over the details of the bill. Here's our correspondent, Sean Curran.
On Tuesday, members of the Scottish Parliament rejected a bill to legalise assisted dying. As peers prepared for another day debating possible changes to the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill, a crossbench or independent peer, Lady Murphy, a psychiatrist, sounded positively jealous.
Isn't it lovely that the Scots could make a vote? Because we will not have the opportunity to make a vote. Yeah. Because people going on and on and on.
More than 1,000 amendments have been proposed to the bill and peers have spent 12 days looking at the details. Lady Murphy said they were wasting time and would never get to the point where they took a decision. When a Conservative former cabinet minister, Lord Harper, blamed the slow progress on peers not getting answers to their questions, he was challenged by the lawyer and crossbench peer, Lord Panic, who suggested opponents of the bill didn't want to reach the next stage of the parliamentary process when there'd be votes on possible amendments.
I know very well why the noble lord is reluctant for us to get to report stage. It's because the result would be exactly what happened on Wednesday night when we debated and decided the decriminalisation of for women who had late-term abortions. There would be lots of talk, there would be passionate speeches, but at the end of the day, the House would vote in favour of a compassionate approach to these issues.
Lord Harper said the two issues were completely separate.
Deciding on assisted suicide is not the same as allowing abortion to term without any legal consequences, which is an extreme provision supported by only 1% of the British public. But I accept that Parliament's made a different decision.
A little later, another Conservative, Lady Nicholson, who's complained that the needs of deaf people have been ignored in the bill, proposed an amendment so that deaf people could have an amanuensis, someone to write for them in any meetings about assisted dying. Closer to home, the former MP complained that the Lords was the worst place she'd ever worked as a deaf person.
We managed to get much better hearing and sight facilities, for example, in the other place many years ago. It is this house that is deficient. I raise that with particular fierceness because I believe it influences the point I'm making.
The bill's sponsor, the Labour former Lord Chancellor, Lord Faulkner, proposed changing the wording of the legislation so that a medical practitioner would have to take all reasonable steps to make sure there was effective communication during a preliminary discussion about assisted dying.
I think everybody in the House would be of the view that the two aims are no discrimination, absolute clarity that somebody's agreed. And that's the basis upon which I, as the sponsor of the bill, approach this matter.
And he agreed to meet Lady Nicholson to discuss his proposals. The Lords will pick up where they left off on Friday.
That was Sean Curran with his report on Yesterday in Parliament.
Now, at 23 minutes past seven, you probably have a rough memory from school of 1066 and all that. And of course, the Bayeux Tapestry's 70-metre depiction of the Battle of Hastings and the Norman Conquest is due to go on display at the British Museum later this year. But new research appears to rewrite a key part of this history. Harold Godwinson's men did not, in fact, march for 200 miles from Yorkshire to Hastings, arriving weary and unprepared for battle. Instead, they made the journey by sea. At least that is the contention of Professor Tom Lysons, Professor of Medieval History and Literature at the University of East Anglia, who joins us now. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Lysons. Simple question, how do you know?
Well, yes, thanks for having me. I was going back over the sources writing this biography of Harold, and I wanted to know how he defended England, so I was looking at troop movements and ship movements, and I noticed that none of the contemporary accounts refer to any march, and there are lots of references to ships which have previously been overlooked.
And those ships to whom the references had been overlooked, you thought, meant that they must have made that journey by ship rather than on foot?
Well, the key thing is there's a statement in the contemporary chronicle known as the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles stating that Harold sent the fleet home. And previously, scholars have argued that meant that he disbanded the fleet. I went through the chronicle examining what the chronicler meant by sent the fleet home. And I found that on previous occasions, he meant send it back to London, the home of the fleet. Homeward to London, he says on a previous occasion. So actually this idea that Harold had disbanded the fleet and therefore had no ships available can be turned on its head to show that he had a fleet. And then that explains all the references to the fleet that we later get in the chronicle and in early Norman accounts, which had previously caused a lot of confusion among historians because they believed that he'd got rid of his fleet and didn't have any ships that he could use to transport troops.
Okay, so apart from clearing up confusion, why does it matter to have a more accurate record of how they arrive for battle?
Well, it changes the story because we've got this idea of Harold as a desperate landlocked defender rushing from one end of the country to the other with exhausted men and presumably contributing to the English defeat at the Battle of Hastings because of that. Whereas if we think of him as a commander operating by land and by sea, which he'd certainly done in the past and which all his contemporaries did, it meant that he could transport his men from the Battle of Stamford Bridge on the 25th of September down the east coast in ships, which is a journey of 3 or 4 days, allowing them to rest to get to London, rather than marching them all the way over 10 or 12 days in a march which historians now widely regard as almost impossible or at least as difficult as any march on record, potentially contributing to English sort of loss at the battle. So it totally rewrites the story and it presents a new image of Harold as a commander.
But it suggests, doesn't it, almost 1,000 years on, just finally, that we need to come up with a new reason why Harold Godwinson lost the battle.
We do. I think we can't blame him for reckless and impulsive haste, as one historian in the past has put it. We need to look to the circumstances of the battle itself to understand why the English lost on the 14th of October 1066.
Well, I, for one, am looking forward to seeing the circumstances of the battle across 70 metres of cloth at the British Museum later this year. Professor Tom Lysons, thank you very much.
It's now 26 minutes past seven. Here's Simon with the sport.
Thanks, Nick. Good morning, Nick. In football, Manchester United drew 2-2 away to Bournemouth in the Premier League last night. Defender Harry Maguire was sent off on the same day that he was recalled to the England squad. United took the lead twice before Maguire was dismissed. Was it harsh? Well, United boss Michael Carrick thinks.
Maybe. It ended up chaos at that time, so decisions going different ways, and he's made that decision. Ours should have been a penalty. We should have had two penalties, and that wouldn't happen.
In tennis, British number two Jack Draper was knocked out of the Miami Open Masters in the second round by Riley Opelka of America in straight sets. The 24-year-old Brit beat Novak Djokovic in the last Masters tournament in Indian Wells, but he was undone by the American's monster serve. Now we can talk to the former top British player turned commentator Barry Cowan. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Simon. Yeah, that was a tough one for Draper last night.
Well, it's a bit of a cliche almost, isn't it, talking about big serving tennis players, but Opelka's 6'11", and he describes himself as a serve bot, and he really can just take the racket out of players' hands, and that's what he seemed to have done against Jack.
Yeah, and in fairly quick conditions, and I think if you were looking at Draper, probably he was the last player, he's probably not the only person, but the last player you want to play is someone like that, that you have no rhythm. But when you look at the numbers, Jack didn't even face a break point and lost in two tie breaks. And Opelka, that's basically where he makes a living. Can he win enough tie breaks in a year? If he does, then obviously his ranking will be pretty high at the end of the season. And I think when you look at Opelka's results so far this year, I think he's been playing well. But I've been really encouraged by Draper, Simon. I think for so long off with that nasty arm injury, he's healthy. I think he's playing at a good level, as we saw how well he played against Djokovic. So it's just he's just about getting miles in his legs at the moment. He'll be fine. I think the ranking will take care of itself by the end of the year.
Yeah, he's dropped from 4th to 26th. What is your prognosis? Because obviously he lost in early at Wimbledon, but he didn't really play after that for the rest of the year.
Yeah, he was struggling at Wimbledon. And then, he tried to come back for the US Open, and that, I think he'll look back and realise that was an error trying to get back too soon. So, yeah, I mean, any time you are a top athlete, you're obviously desperate to get out there competing. But I think sometimes you just got to make sure you're 100% fit. And then tennis is brutal because, that Federer comment, was it last year? I think he said, in his career, he only won 55% of his points. Mm. And he was one of the greatest players we've ever seen. So it is just such small margins, as we saw with that match yesterday with Draper. So, when you haven't had that many matches, those are the type of moments that can be more difficult. So, he's got the clay coming up after now that this mini hard court season, and I think almost at times that might be a little bit more favourable for Jack because it gives him a little bit more time. Mm. He's made a few technical changes with the serve, with the strings. So I think it's just about putting everything in together. And as I said, the results will take care of itself. And it might not be the next 2 or 3 months. We might start to see the best of Jack. Yeah, probably maybe July, August.
Wins as well for Katie Bolter and Carlos Alcaraz, who beat the Brazilian 19-year-old João Fonseca, who's tipped to potentially trouble Sinner and Alcaraz at the top of the game. Barry, thank you very much. And just very quickly, away from the tennis, Rugby Union Bath blew away Saracens on their return to Premier League action. They won 62-15 at the Recreation Ground, and we'll be back looking ahead to the League Cup final in an hour's time.
Thank you, Simon. Now let's have a look ahead to Broadcasting House tomorrow, which is of course presented by Paddy O'Connell. Morning, Paddy.
Henry Z, how lovely to hear you on my radio. Europe's ungrateful cowards are moaning about oil prices. This is the verdict of the US president on his new war, as you know. We hear a lot from him, but we will hear instead from voices from within Iran. Both its regime and its enemies know this is the key, the clock. The aviation industry is in hiatus. We talk about the millions of flights being rerouted. At home, we've music inspired by nature. We put up bird boxes in Pembrokeshire, and a car mechanic talks about the scourge of potholes. But can you tell us if they're worse for people on two wheels? That's BH tomorrow morning at 9.
That was Paddy O talking to Henry Z, a name that I think might well catch on. Quick look at the weather now. Today we'll see areas of mist and fog, slow to clear in the morning, leaving sunny spells and variable cloud for most.
It's 29 minutes to 8. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Henry Zeffman. And now time for a summary of the news from Lisa Costello.
The semi-official Iranian news agency Mehr says Tehran has fired two ballistic missiles at the joint US-UK military base Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. Earlier, the Wall Street Journal reported two missiles were fired toward the base, but that they didn't hit it. Yesterday, the Prime Minister agreed to let the US use British bases to target sites from which Iran is attacking the Strait of Hormuz. President Trump has said the US is considering winding down its military campaign in Iran as it gets close to meeting its objectives. But earlier he told reporters he didn't want a ceasefire. The mixed messages come as the BBC's American partner CBS reports that US military officials are making detailed preparations for the possibility of deploying ground troops in Iran. Ukrainian and American negotiators are expected to hold more talks in the United States today on how to end the war with Russia. The discussions have been on hold since the US and Israel launched their attack on Iran 3 weeks ago. More than 5,700 people have now been vaccinated against meningitis after an outbreak of the infection in Kent. At least 29 cases have been confirmed, and a fifth clinic will open today in Margate offering the jab. There are growing calls for the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, to give evidence about what she knows about Jeffrey Epstein. Her representatives declined to comment. There is no legal mechanism to compel her to testify in the US. A jury in California has found that Elon Musk deliberately misled shareholders in the social media company Twitter while he was bidding to buy the company. It concluded he'd been trying to pay less than his original bid. He eventually bought the site and renamed it X, but at the time he'd tweeted that Twitter had too many fake accounts and threatened to pull out of the deal. It's not clear what he'll have to pay in damages, but it's expected to run into billions.
Lisa, thanks. It's 27 minutes to eight. This was the week when the cost of the war in the Middle East came home for drivers, for homeowners, for farmers, all driven not just by the soaring price of oil and of gas, but also ammonia, which makes the fertilisers which farmers depend on. Listen to this rather alarming analysis by the head of the International Energy Authority, Fatih Birol.
Our world is facing the greatest global energy security challenge in the history. It is much bigger than what we had in the 1970s, the oil price shocks. It is also bigger than the natural gas price shock we have experienced after the Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Well, listening to that, the president of the National Farmers Union, Tom Bradshaw, and Over Energy's vice president for policy regulation and risk, Mary Starks. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Tom, try and cheer us up a bit, because I imagine your members are not at all cheerful, but that sounded like the worst sort of crisis we'd seen in decades. Is that how it feels for your members, or is it difficult but not quite as bad as that suggests?
I think at the moment it's definitely in the difficult category, but if it continues for any prolonged period of time, then this is going to have a dramatic impact. And I'm afraid it's not just farmers. It's all of your listeners today that are sitting down having their breakfast. It's 70 million people living on an island. And fossil fuels have such an impact right the way through from farm all the way through to the kitchen table. It's inflationary right the way through that supply chain. So we are really concerned about what this means for, yes, the immediate short term, particularly on imported product, on glasshouse product, where those gas costs hit immediately. The medium term for crop growth, for grass growth. But the longer term, if we can't get hold of those products, then fertilizers, diesels are absolutely essential for continuing to produce the country's food.
Now, those of us who were not farmers learned during the Ukraine war the importance of fertilizer supply. How big a factor in the cost of the food we eat is it?
Oh, it's a very significant factor. I mean, so it's the largest cost input that we have on farm. Around the world, around half of the people are alive on the planet because of artificial fertilizer, because it helps produce the calories that everybody relies on. And that Middle East region is so important for producing the gas, which ultimately goes into producing the fertilizer products. So while we may not source much of our fertilizer directly from that region, it will turn the world supply upside down and it will have a dramatic impact. We don't produce any fertilizer from raw ingredients in this country anymore. It's all completely reliant on imported fertiliser. So we are absolutely at the mercy of world markets.
And a quick reflection, Tom, before I turn to Mary, on the speed of all this. We're already seeing some products' prices rocket in the shops. But is there a delay, as we're about to hear there will be in our household energy bills, or is it pretty much happening now?
So the product which is being imported into the country, the transport costs rise immediately. For our glasshouse horticultural production, things like cucumbers, peppers, tomatoes, it'll be over the next month, 6 weeks that we see those cost increases coming through to the retailer. And then for some of our field scale produce and some of our crops and milk and things like that, it'll be the next 3 to 6 months that we start to see those prices coming through. But farmers cannot afford to absorb any of these cost increases if we're going to have a resilient supply chain.
Yeah, so more and pressure on the Chancellor, I suspect. Tom, if you'll forgive me, I'm going to turn to Mary just on this timing issue, first of all, if you would, Mary, because it's not good news, but it's delayed bad news, isn't it? There is a delay before people's home energy bills go up.
Yeah, that's right. It depends what kind of contract you're on. If you bought a 2-year fixed contract in February, you'll be feeling pretty comfortable right now. But for a lot of customers who are on the standard variable tariff, they'll see prices actually go down in April. And then the concern is what happens to prices in July when the next cap quarter comes in. So the cap sets prices in sort of 3-month blocks.
Now,
and we've got a whole block to go before we need to worry about this.
Yeah, so that gives the government some decision-making time and space, if you like. The Chancellor said yesterday that she hoped to be able to provide, quote, targeted support to the poorest households if the conflict prolonged. And she said something else interesting. We're more advanced on this occasion, she meant, than we were after the invasion of Ukraine. Are you in the industry seeing those preparations?
We are involved in a lot of conversations with government about that. I think the worry is that we are not yet in a much stronger situation in terms of being able to target support really well to who needs it. So, you know, we've got some targeting measures, so we could do something better than we did last time. But it's we'd like to see the government really put a push on getting a proper household income data so that we can target to support to the households that really struggle if this happens.
There is, of course, not just the issue of how poor you are, but how much energy you use, because there are certain people with health conditions that may not be conventionally regarded as very poor, but have vast energy bills.
Yeah, and that's why we'd like to see the help come in the form of a discount to the unit rate, if you like. So the current warm home discount is a flat handout. It's £150 that you either get or you don't get. I think if we were able to cushion the price impact for the most vulnerable customers, that would, you know, the more you use, the more help you would get in that situation.
But just to be clear, you are not yet in the industry seeing a plan that you're engaged with. Lots of conversations, but no plan.
Lots of conversations, but no plan. But we wouldn't necessarily expect the government to take those decisions until they needed to, if you see what I mean. So it doesn't feel wrong that we're still talking. It's important that we keep on talking.
Mary Starks of OVO, Tom Bradshaw of the National Farmers Union, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid the grim advice seems to be you have to prepare now for really soaring bills come the summer.
Indeed. At 21 minutes to 8... The patent for semaglutide, the molecule behind the Danish drug maker Novo Nordisk's weight loss jabs like Ozempic and Wegovy, expired in India on Friday. That means competition. Domestic pharmaceutical companies in India can release cheaper copies, generics. And competition probably means lower prices and higher uptake of the drugs. Well, joining us to talk through the implications is Naveed Sattar. He's the UK government's obesity mission chair and professor of metabolic medicine at Glasgow University. Good morning, Professor Sattar.
Yeah, good morning, Henry.
We'll come to the implications this might have for the UK in a moment. But first, just tell us what you think the impact of this patent expiring will be in India.
Well, I've spoken to some of my Indian colleagues, and they think there will be an absolute tsunami of semaglutide use in their population. There are over, as you know, 40 manufacturers making 50 different types of generic brands for semaglutide. The costs are likely to come down by more than 50%. And there's a huge need in India. The number of people living with diabetes is skyrocketing. Obesity is going up really fast. So that creates a substantial market for this type of product. And obviously the evidence base for semaglutide in helping people not put on weight, in helping people with their diabetes, preventing diabetes and improving many other chronic conditions, is really quite strong.
And I think a lot of people will be quite encouraged by that. But just on the sort of patent aspect of this, why have they allowed it to expire?
Ah, that I don't know. So you'd have to ask Novo Nordisk. But the conventional wisdom is this was an oversight on someone's part within the company. And obviously, the patent expiry is not just in India this year. It's also in China, Canada, Brazil, Turkey, amongst sort of five or six of the six countries. The patent doesn't expire in the UK, or is not supposed to, at least until around about 2030, 2031. So this is certainly, if it is an oversight, it's quite a substantial oversight.
Yeah, because as you mentioned, quite a few other countries, China, Turkey, Brazil. So even if it doesn't expire in the UK anytime soon, can we expect a global impact from these cheaper generics coming on stream in India and other countries?
We may well do. People may well be trying to buy this, from generic companies in India. They're not, really that's not supposed to happen. You're supposed to buy them within your own country under regulation. But let's see what happens. And if that does start to happen and the market then sees that happening, the cost of actual semaglutide may come down in many other countries, including the UK. So some people describe this as healthy competition, but let's see. The key thing within India, of course, is how tightly is this going to be regulated? And can they stop poor generics? Can they stop misuse? And will there be some initial teething problems? And will regulators have to tighten the rules in India so that really high-quality generics are used long-term?
Well, because just finally, that's an important concern, isn't it? Certainly, in all parts of the world, these jabs have had near miraculous effects on people who've been trying to lose weight, perhaps in some cases for decades. But there's concern even with the sort of pucker ones, as it were, of potential side effects. And perhaps with generics, cheaper generics, especially if they're produced quickly, that concern would be magnified.
Potentially, let's see what happens. I mean, the thought is that weaker players who have, really poor quality drug will probably fall away in the next 2-3 years, and really high quality generics will stay in the market in India. That's the wisdom. The side effects, as you say, yes, it's nausea and vomiting when people in the small proportion who start the drugs, but that usually tails off in the majority. And I suspect regulation will need to come into India, and I suspect physician education will rapidly rise so that they kind of gravitate towards the best quality generics, give better advice. And I think the really big thing is, it's really a huge public health experiment, is what is going to happen to the diabetes and obesity rates in India over the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay, well, we'll be watching closely on this programme, I'm sure. Professor Naveed Sattar, thank you very much.
Time now is 16 minutes to 8. Now it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Chinning McDonald, Director of Theos, the Religion and Society Think Tank.
Good morning. The words of Jessie Buckley dedicating her Oscar win to the beautiful chaos of a mother's heart have been echoing in my mind throughout this week. She picked up the Best Actress Award for playing a grieving mother in Hamlet. The film reimagines the lives of William Shakespeare and his wife Anne Hathaway as they cope with the tragic death of their 11-year-old son. This idea of the beautiful chaos of a mother's heart moves us beyond the saccharine pinks and yellow flowers of Mother's Day to the reality that motherhood is wild and earth-shattering and terrifying. My goodness, can it be joyous too? But for many mothers, it is all those things, sometimes all at once. But sometimes the chaos of a mother's heart has to deal with the worst thing imaginable, the death of a child. On Thursday night, I hosted an event in conversation with G. Walker at Chester Cathedral, exploring black motherhood and grief. G.'s 18-year-old son, Anthony, was murdered in a racially aggravated attack while walking near his home in Merseyside 20 years ago. In the book by Maggie O'Farrell, upon which the film Hamlet is based, are these words: "Never take for granted that your children's hearts beat, that they sup milk, that they draw breath, that they walk and speak and smile and argue and play. Never forget that they may be gone, snatched from you in the blink of an eye, borne away from you like thistledown." I had planned to ask G. Walker at the end of our event what gives her hope, but I couldn't bring myself to. I resisted the urge to wrap her grief up in a tidy bow, to end on a glib message so we could all go away feeling better. This Easter, Christians will celebrate Jesus' resurrection, the great story at the heart of my faith. But perhaps what many of us also take from Holy Week is that resurrection doesn't erase the reality of the brutality of Christ's crucifixion, his mother watching it all at the foot of the cross. G. Walker told me she finds solidarity in Mama Mary, as she describes Jesus' mother. A mother who, just like her, experienced the nightmare of watching her son die and not being able to do anything to help, not even to be able to hold him. She described doing the little that she was able to while Anthony lay dying, holding tightly to his feet while police and paramedics intervened. In the months following Anthony's death, G's family started the Anthony Walker Foundation, raising aspirations of school children and providing comfort to other grieving families. For her, it's through this work that Anthony lives on. So too did Mary, mother in movement, that took her son's message to the ends of the earth. Perhaps the beautiful chaos of a mother's heart is that even when it is broken, it can speak life.
That was Thought for the Day with Chinny McDonald. It's now 13 minutes to 8.
It's just over 3 months since Australia introduced its world-first ban on social media for under-16s. Shortly before Christmas, younger teenagers were, according to the law at least, kicked off the likes of TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, Snapchat and plenty else besides. A pioneering move, but intensely criticised by tech companies, just as it was widely welcomed by parents and carers. So, how's it going? Well, our Australia correspondent Katie Watson sent us this report from Sydney.
Kids under the age of 16 have been shut out of multiple sites, including Facebook, Instagram and Snapchat.
It's a huge social experiment.
Kids across Australia are waking up to a world...
with Australian teens, the guinea pigs.
Australia va a prohibir las redes sociales.
And when the legislation kicked in on December the 10th, the whole world was watching it play out.
And then the grading is negative 2 over 3. We could choose to put the negative...
More than 2 million youngsters here were targeted by the ban. So, 3 months on, what's their new reality? We went to PLC Sydney, a school in the city's inner west, to speak to some teens.
I have Instagram, I have TikTok, I have Snapchat. I wasn't kicked off of any of them. I know of 3 girls out of my entire year group, which is 180, that have been impacted.
None of my accounts got banned, which was a bit anticlimactic.
I got kicked off social media. I was kind of hoping that it would allow me to be more productive. However, I've found that I've just... found other ways to procrastinate.
Despite this anecdotal evidence that many teens are still on platforms, the government has released some data saying that within weeks of the ban starting, 4.7 million accounts belonging to under-16s had been closed down. So does that mean it's working? Professor Amanda Third is co-director of the Young and Resilient Research Centre at Western Sydney University.
What might not be clear to the public is that there are sort of 2 stages of implementing the ban. The first has been for platforms to identify all those accounts of underage users who've declared their age to be under 16. And the second phase, which will roll out in the next 6 months, is about using age inference technologies to identify which users, according to their habits, their connections, their practices, which users are underage, and they'll then be removed from the platform.
So those who we spoke to thinking they're safe aren't necessarily?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, again, we expect that more users will be caught by the legislation in the near future.
PLC Sydney's principal, Paul Burgess, accepts it's going to take a long time to make a real difference.
I don't actually think we're going to see the real benefits from the ban for about 4 or 5 years' time. The real move is for the student who's currently a 10 or 11-year-old and the parents not buying a phone for them until they finish, maybe when they're 15.
We're looking at a range of options. We're obviously looking at what's happened in Australia, something I've discussed with the Australian Prime Minister.
And that's the challenge for countries like the UK, looking at adopting laws of their own. They're having to base their decisions on public sentiment and little hard data.
I'm Harriet Alder. I'm 15 years old and I'm in year 11 at school.
Harriet has 2 sisters, Beatrix and Tamsin. She's the only one with social media. They've got cousins in the UK. So what advice would they have for British kids facing a ban of their own?
I actually got Snapchat in England when I was on holiday there, and I was with my cousin when I got it. So she actually recommended putting my age a bit older. So I think that even though at that point in time they had no idea about this ban, lots of people are aware of like putting your age a lot older.
And any advice you give to a teen thinking my life is going to be ruined?
Quickly change your age right now.
You can't do that though. People might come at me for saying this, but I feel like if you've never experienced it and you never get addicted to the algorithms, then it's really not that bad. Like my life, sometimes I'm a bit left out from like some inside jokes that are on social media and some trends, but for the most part, I'm fine.
The government hopes that by at least trying to keep teens off social media, it's starting a conversation and a cultural shift.
Well, that conversation has certainly come to the UK, and the cultural shift may not be far behind. In January, under pressure from dozens of Labour MPs, as well as the Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrats, all calling for an Australia-style ban, the government said it would look at whether to ban under-16s from using social media here in the UK too. A public consultation is underway and will close in May. One of the most prominent voices calling for a ban here is Justine Roberts, the founder and executive chair of Mumsnet, and she joins us now. Good morning, Justine.
Good morning.
Well, you heard there from wily teenagers who say that their social media use has been unaffected since the ban. Is that a sign that the ban isn't working?
No, I don't think so. As was mentioned in your piece by some very sage teenager at the end, I think it's about shifting the norms. Right now, parents are struggling very badly with this. We hear about this every day on Mumsnet. It's a constant battle with effectively, some addicted people in their homes who are desperate to access their social media. I think being a parent, the one parent now who says no, is incredibly difficult. And what we need is collective action. I think even if it at the beginning isn't perfect, it doesn't really matter. It's about arming parents with the ability to say, this is normal for me to not get you a phone or get you a phone with restrictions. And I think as time goes on, big tech, we know how clever the big tech companies are, I think they will be able to infer age, and they probably are already, and they're going to be forced to by things and by conversations you're having online. So I think this, the Australia example, will get better and better and better. And it's about resetting the norms and empowering parents with the ability to not be the only bad guys out there.
So we heard a lot there from the kids, the younger teenagers. Actually, in your eyes, and I guess this makes sense given the experience of parents that you hear all the time at Mumsnet, a ban is more than anything actually about giving parents the license to say no to their kids.
Yeah, I mean, and that sounds very weak, but it's not just the license to say no. It's living day to day with trying to restrict someone who's incredibly addicted. We're all addicted to our phones, but I think...
Tell me about
But I think some of us, we're not... Our brains are not in the maturing stage, and we're not constantly being dinged by the algorithm when our brains are being formed. We know these social media and phones cause harm. 92% of parents on Mumsnet are concerned about the effect of social media on children's mental health and well-being. 61% say their child is addicted to the phone. We know that teen phone addiction has an association with anxiety, with it triples the risk of depression, and 3 hours a day of social media makes teens more likely to self-harm. And so there are really bad effects. This is a public health crisis, and parents need help in fighting the algorithms. I mean, you cannot out-parent big tech's algorithms.
I mean, those are striking, alarming statistics. But it's also especially striking because it's not so long ago, I think, that actually people, including many parents, were talking up the advantages that big tech could have during childhood, certainly in sort of transforming educational outcomes, for example. And that's one of the arguments, as you'll be familiar with, that big tech makes. So take YouTube, which is one of the platforms which has been included in Australia's ban. Well, they say this misunderstands the platform and that actually it's an educational video sharing site. Do you worry at all that if this ban is rushed, for example, in the UK, if there is a ban, that it risks throwing out the baby with the bathwater?
I don't think there's any danger of this ban being rushed. There's a six-month consultation or three-month consultation. I don't think, if anything, I think it will be kicked down the line because government is under pressure from big tech. And the big tech playbook is being played out here. It was in Australia. And they will come up with all kinds of arguments.
Interesting. So you're quite pessimistic, actually, about the government ultimately doing this, or you fear that it will be scaled back under pressure?
I think there's a risk, and that's why I think we need to keep on about the fact that this is a public health disaster. And it's a classic collective action problem that government is actually designed to. That's why government is there, to deal with these things. And look, I'm not saying obviously I'm the founder of Mumsnet. I'm not saying all tech is bad or even all social media is bad. I just think that, exposing our kids to these highly addictive algorithms has, clearly got a correlation with some very bad mental health outcomes. And I think it would be like smoking. We'll look back in 20 years and think, how the hell did we allow our kids to have access to this stuff? Unfortunately, we were the guinea pig generation. We didn't really know. And I wish to this day I'd been stricter with my kids and their habits. But we are beginning to know now. There's such a body of evidence coming out. And that's why 83% of our Mumsnet users want the government to act.
Okay.
And they also say they're more likely to support a party that does something about this.
A message which I'm sure will be heard loud and clear in Whitehall this morning. Justine Roberts, founder of Mumsnet, thank you very much.
Time for a word from Lauren Laverne about who she's been in conversation with recently.
Discover the latest castaways to the desert island.
When I first saw Heart, I was just totally mesmerised by its rhythm.
Including the surgeon, Professor Stephen Westerby, and the Academy Award-winning Jessie Buckley.
And I remember she had this little mushroom stool in her office at the time, and I looked up at her and I said, I want to be Judi Dench.
And my next castaway is the comedian, Sarah Pascoe.
The problem I'm going to have is that I've got a plant-based diet, and I think I am going to have to probably, for sustenance, just find an animal I dislike and eat him.
Desert Island Discs with me, Lauren Laverne, Sunday mornings at 10. To listen on your smart speaker, say Play Radio 4.
Time now for a look at the weather. Simon King is at the BBC Weather Centre for us this morning.
Hi, Henry. Good morning, everybody. We have got some fine weather again for most parts of the UK. It's been quite a chilly start, and there have been some mist and fog patches out there this morning as well, which could be a little bit slow to clear away. But as I said, for many of us, there'll be some sunshine. So for southwest England and Wales, starting off mostly sunny this morning, any mist and fog clearing. There will be a little bit of low cloud just lingering around those Irish Sea coasts in West Wales into the afternoon. Elsewhere, staying sunny with highs of 11 to 15 degrees. Southeast England, the Midlands and Eastern England, fog patches continuing to clear. Lots of blue skies and sunshine that will continue into the afternoon. Highs of 11 to 15 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, we've got more extensive fog patches, especially around the Vale of York, and they will be a little bit slow to clear away. So do watch out for that if you are travelling this morning. But they will eventually clear and there'll be some sunshine. Temperatures 11 to 15 Celsius. For Northern Ireland, starting off sunny here, we might just see some higher cloud moving its way in later, making the sunshine turn hazy, highs of 11 to 13. And for Scotland, sunshine for central, southern and eastern areas today, but further north and west we've got thicker cloud, could see a few showers around the Northern Isles, and top temperatures 10 to 14 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Henry Zeffman and Nick Robinson.
It's 8 o'clock on Saturday the 21st of March. The headlines this morning. A news agency linked to the Iranian government says Tehran has fired two missiles at the joint UK-US military base Diego Garcia. The UK government has yet to comment. The Prime Minister will hold a meeting with ministers and the Governor of the Bank of England to discuss helping households with rising energy costs. And Ukrainian and American officials are expected to return to talks on ending the war with Russia.
Coming up in the next hour, we'll hear from Alan Bennett talking about his new diaries covering Brexit, the pandemic and the late Queen, and why he'll never give up writing.
Well, I don't see why I should stop. It's all I've got.
And we remember Dame Jenny Murray, one of the defining voices of Radio 4. Join us before 9 o'clock, her former editor and Dame Harriet Harman, who said last night she was the broadcasting wing of the women's movement.
I'm Simon in Monday with your Saturday sport. Harry Maguire had a mixed day, recalled to the England squad in the morning, sent off as Manchester United drew with Bournemouth in the evening. And it is the League Cup final tomorrow, Arsenal against Manchester City at Wembley. I'll be looking ahead with Lee Dixon and David James.
That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Lisa Costello.
Iran has fired two ballistic missiles at the joint US-UK military base in the Chagos Islands, according to a news agency linked to the Iranian government. Yesterday, Sir Keir Starmer gave Washington permission to use British bases to target sites from which Iran was attacking the Strait of Hormuz, describing the move as a defensive action. In response, Tehran said it would exercise its right to defend itself. From Jerusalem, our correspondent James Waterhouse reports.
The two ballistic missiles reportedly launched by Iran at the US-UK Diego Garcia military base in the Indian Ocean missed their target. But Iranian state media claims its targeting shows how the range of Iran's missiles is beyond what its enemies had previously imagined. Had any damage been sustained, it would have only added to the political pressure on the UK to extend its military involvement in this three-week war. Donald Trump says the US is close to meeting its objectives and may begin winding down its military campaign, despite reports he is looking to commit troops to loosen Iran's tight grip on the Strait of Hormuz, which 20% of the world's oil used to pass through. Israel has continued its missile strikes on what it called Iranian regime targets and seems happy to pursue its own military goals as long as Donald Trump continues to throw America's weight behind its military operation.
The US has temporarily lifted sanctions on Iranian oil already at sea in an effort to contain the war's effect on energy markets. The 30-day waiver applies to oil loaded onto vessels before yesterday. The US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said it would bring 140 million barrels of oil to global markets. Sir Keir Starmer will next week hold an emergency meeting of senior ministers and the Governor of the Bank of England to discuss how to deal with the effects of the war on the UK. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
The disruption to oil and gas supplies from the Persian Gulf is already having a cascading series of impacts in the UK. So next week, ministers and the Bank of England will urgently consider what could be done to help households here. Yesterday, Downing Street described Iran's attacks on shipping as reckless. Ministers agreed that US aircraft operating from British bases can now strike any sites from which Iran is targeting ships in the Strait of Hormuz. Downing Street argues it is still only allowing defensive actions that protect the UK's interests and allies. Donald Trump was not impressed, saying the UK should have acted a lot faster. The Conservatives accused Sir Keir of dithering and changing his mind, while the Liberal Democrats said they feared the UK was being dragged into a war with no obvious end.
The Israeli military has launched a series of strikes on the Lebanese capital Beirut overnight against what it said were Hezbollah targets. Lebanese state media has also reported attacks in the south of the country, close to the border with Israel, and said one person had been killed. Ukrainian and American negotiators are expected to meet in the United States later today for another round of talks on ending the war with Russia. The discussions have been on hold since the US and Israel first launched their attacks on Iran 3 weeks ago. From Kiev, here's Vitaly Shevchenko.
The Iran war has not just overshadowed Ukraine, it has also affected it. President Zelensky wants his negotiators to discuss the recent easing of American sanctions on Russian oil, implemented by Washington to help keep down global energy prices. Ukraine is also offering its drone expertise and technology, which could be useful in fighting and defending against Iran. Also on the agenda is setting up another trilateral meeting involving Russia, as well as efforts to smooth over the rocky relationship between Volodymyr Zelensky and Donald Trump, who has accused the Ukrainian leader of being the main obstacle to peace. So far, all the rounds of talks spearheaded and mediated by the US have failed to stop the fighting in Ukraine or change Russia's demands. And there is little hope for a breakthrough now.
In the past hour, Ukrainian authorities have said two people have been killed in a Russian drone attack on the city of Zaporizhia. Two children, aged 11 and 15, were injured. More than 5,700 people have now been vaccinated against meningitis after an outbreak of the infection in Kent. At least 29 cases have been identified. There are growing calls for the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, to give evidence about what she knows about Jeffrey Epstein. Politicians in the US have repeatedly called for her ex-husband, Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, to answer questions about his links to the late American financier and sex offender. Her representatives declined to comment. Our royal correspondent, Noor Nanji, reports.
Sarah Ferguson has not been seen publicly for months. Meanwhile, pressure is growing in the US for the former Duchess to give evidence on Jeffrey Epstein. Congressman Suha Subramaniam, a member of the US House Oversight Committee investigating the handling of his prosecution, told the BBC he now believes she had information related to the investigation. While the Democratic Congresswoman Melanie Stansbury urged anyone with information of wrongdoing by Epstein to cooperate in order to ensure justice for survivors. The family of the prominent Epstein accuser, Virginia Giuffre, also said they strongly believe Sarah Ferguson should travel to the US to answer questions. New details about Sarah Ferguson's friendship with Epstein emerged in the millions of documents released by the US Department of Justice earlier this year. Being named in the Epstein files is not an indication of wrongdoing. Sarah Ferguson's representatives declined to comment.
11 people have been killed and nearly 60 injured in a massive fire at a car parts factory in the South Korean city of Daejeon. Video footage shows huge flames and thick smoke billowing out of the building. A jury in the US has found that the world's richest man, Elon Musk, misled shareholders when buying Twitter in 2022. Mr. Musk was accused of falsely claiming the site underreported how many bot accounts were active on the platform in an attempt to drive down the price. Our North America tech correspondent Lily Jamali reports.
The 9-person jury found Mr. Musk tried to drive down the share price of Twitter, now known as X, as he was bidding to buy it. Shareholders suing claimed he wanted to either renegotiate the $44 billion deal to acquire the platform or back out. Jurors took almost 4 days to reach their conclusion that he misled investors who sold their shares following posts and comments Mr. Musk made as the deal was nearing completion. But the jury stopped short of finding that his commentary was part of a scheme to defraud shareholders. Their lawyers said Mr. Musk may end up paying their clients the equivalent of $2.5 billion.
New research suggests the famous march of King Harold's troops to the Battle of Hastings in 1066 didn't actually happen. An academic at the University of East Anglia argues this episode in English history was instead the result of a Victorian misunderstanding. Rebecca Drought has the details.
The near 200-mile, 10-day march of King Harold's army to face the Norman invasion is such a famous moment in English history it was reenacted to mark the 950th anniversary just a decade ago. But only a mad general, Professor Tom Lysons argues, would have sent all his men from Yorkshire to Sussex on foot if ships were available. He's been looking again at the evidence for how the troops made their way south and believes the journey was undertaken largely by sea. He says contemporary sources describe hundreds of ships being used to support Harold's campaign against the Viking invasion in the north before heading back south, and he argues there's no evidence of a forced march. Victorian historians, he says, misinterpreted a reference to the fleet coming home as meaning it was disbanded, but their home base was in London.
More than £30 million has been raised for comic relief. Stars such as Idris Elba, Greg James and Anna Friel featured in last night's Red Nose Day programme on BBC One. Nick Johnson reports.
Catherine Tate's belligerent Nan character kicked off the BBC One broadcast with a rendition of Queen's Don't Stop Me Now, alongside an assembly of dancers dressed as grandmas. The fundraiser, hosted by Davina McCall, also included a parody of The Traitors, featuring the likes of Alison Steadman, Scott Mills and Anna Friel, who played host Claudia Winkleman.
Now solving that anagram releases a giant wooden horse.
called Jeff.
The funds raised will support projects that provide access to food and shelter for people facing hardship in the UK and around the world.
Nick Johnson reporting.
Lisa, thank you. It's now 8:10. Is Britain being dragged deeper and deeper into Donald Trump's war? Or is the latest change in British policy not much more than a tweak, driven simply by what's needed to defend the national interest? First, the Prime Minister told us that the UK had played no part in the US-Israeli attack on Iran. Then came the news that US Air Force bombers were to be permitted to use British bases after all, albeit only to carry out what were described as defensive operations. Now, in a decision taken yesterday by the War Cabinet, that permission has been extended to allow strikes against Iranian targets that are targeting the Straits of Hormuz. It wasn't enough to impress the Commander-in-Chief. President Trump spoke to reporters last night before boarding Marine Force One.
Well, it's been a very late response from the UK. Surprise, because the relationship is so good, but this has never happened before. They were really pretty much our first ally all over the world, first ally, and they didn't want us to use the island, the so-called island, which for some reason they gave up rights to it. And I was a little surprised at the UK, to be honest with you. They should have acted a lot faster.
The so-called island he's referring to is Diego Garcia. Now, the Iranian news agency has reported a missile attack on Diego Garcia. That is not yet confirmed. It would be rather significant if it is. Let's explore what we've been hearing there with General Sir Richard Barons, former Director of Operations for the British Armed Forces, and the Labour MP John McDonnell, former Shadow Chancellor. Good morning to you both.
Morning. Morning.
General Sir Richard, who is right? Trump suggesting this decision to extend the permission given to use US Air Force bases is both little and late, or those like Mr. McDonnell we'll hear from in a second who think we're being sucked into an American war?
So I think both could be true, in as much as war generally doesn't follow a script and the enemy always gets a vote. And in this case, the enemy's vote, Iran, has been serially underestimated. And we are, I think, where we are, which is this conflict in the way it's turned out, now does put British interests and those of our allies at risk. And ignoring it completely is no longer appropriate, even if the decisions at the start of the conflict were very different.
The Iranian foreign minister tweeted last night, ignoring his own people, Mr. Starmer, as he put it, is putting British lives in danger by allowing UK bases to be used for aggression against Iran. When you heard that news, if it is confirmed, we must stress that about the missile attack on Diego Garcia, did it make you think he might be right?
So I don't think there's any surprise attached to that. Iran and the UK have been at odds for a very long time. Iran regards the UK, or at least the regime in Iran, regards the UK as an enemy. And so if we are seen to participate in some fashion with this US-Israeli offensive action, then they are clearly going to respond. We shouldn't be surprised by that.
Interesting use of the word offensive, because, of course, the government's position is, and it's legal, not just its political position, is this is defensive. And hitting targets that are themselves targeting shipping in the Straits of Hormuz, they are presenting it as defending the national interest rather than an act of aggression against Iran.
I think it's a rather fine judgment, because you're helping someone apply military force. But for me, the key issue is where we are now is that Iran is targeting British interests and those of our allies, and we have obligations to them. And we may not have thought this was a good idea at the start, and we may not have wanted to get involved. But now, in the way this has turned out, we are involved.
Well, let's put that to John McDonnell. What about that argument that says the situation has changed and therefore we have to change?
I think that's true. We do have to change. That doesn't mean to say that we have to follow Donald Trump. We're a sovereign country. We're not some Trump colony. And the problem with these wars is that it is those small steps that eventually get you onto an escalator into a serious conflict. And that's what I'm worried about. for me, what's happening is that decisions are being taken by Trump and Netanyahu, which we're not part of. And as a result of that, they then expect us almost automatically to back them up. And I think it's becoming almost impossible to distinguish between what is defensive and what is aggressive. And the problem that we have now is that it's the instability of the decision making by Donald Trump and Netanyahu. From what we've, the track record so far, is that they, first of all, they broke the broke down the discussions around the nuclear threat. We now know actually a deal could have been secured. They launched the attack. We know from Marco Rubio that Israel were launching the attack, so America thought they'd better get behind them. We weren't party to any of that. And then after that, the latest decisions taken about attacking the oil and gas site, we weren't party to that. And yet now they're expecting us to allow them to use our bases in what is clearly part and parcel of an aggressive act.
Yeah, but
and
General Sir Richard's point is, forgive me, address General Sir Richard Barron's point, if you would, which is whatever your initial position on the war, you have no choice as a government but to defend your sovereign interests. And defending tankers trying to make their way through the Strait of Hormuz in order to keep the wheels of the economy turning is absolutely in our national interest. And I might say, John McDonnell, in the interest of your voters as well.
Of course, Nick. But, you know, there is oil moving through. And it's oil that's going to India because they're not part of the military action at all. And so what it says to me is that the military action is leading us to an even greater conflagration. Trump is now talking about troops on the ground. So does that now mean we have to take action to support them? We are being dragged in. So the way forward is actually to start de-escalating and to secure a peace agreement.
And what can MPs who think as you do, the Liberal Democrats have been highly critical, the Green Party have been highly critical, will you all work together to try and change the Prime Minister's mind in Parliament?
I think these issues go above party, completely above party. We have to represent our constituents, we have to represent our country. So there will be a large number of MPs, I think, who are saying, look, we just cannot follow every strategy devised by Netanyahu and Trump together at the risk to our own country. There must be another route, and the route that others have taken are to secure agreement. And that's, but we need to get back
onto the
stage.
Forgive me, my question there was what you do to bring that about. It's a vote in Parliament that you would like to try and trigger, is it?
Well, first of all, we want to try and at least have the debate and the discussion to try and influence our own government. And yes, you know, Keir Starmer did say when he was elected leader of the Labour Party that we should always have a vote before there's military action. He said no a few weeks ago because he said this was about defensive action. Well, this is merging into aggressive action.
Well, let me return to General Sir Richard to pick up your point about the use of ground troops. It was a puzzle. Sir Richard, wasn't it last night, that on the one hand we had the president talk about winding down the war, and on the other, reports not from him, to be fair, but from CBS News in the States, backed up in quotes from the White House press spokesman, that they were considering the use of ground troops. Now, no one knows whether that is for a full-scale invasion or a rather limited move, for example, to seize an Iranian oil field or to seize some of the nuclear material that they want to make sure is no longer held in the country. What do you make of what you're hearing there?
So I think at the heart of it is the disquiet in President Trump's mind about how this war has turned out. I mean, I think it'll go down in military history as a case study in how a mismatch between what you would like to achieve, your objectives, and the means you're prepared to apply to them is so profound that they have ended up in a situation where they've done about as much as they can with the use of air power. And it's not going to deliver the outcomes that they wanted. It will have delivered some outcomes. And they've got to choose between now announcing victory and stopping because they've essentially culminated. Or if those objectives really matter a lot to them, they're going to have to escalate and you can't do much more with air power. So they're beginning to talk about potentially using troops. I mean, I don't think anyone really conceives of an invasion and an occupation of Iran. It's the size of Western Europe, but they're going to be tempted perhaps to do raids on places like Karg Island or to blockade it or attack the littoral of Iran in order to remove the military threat. Now, Making that successful will be very difficult. It would rely on the support of the Gulf states, since they will have to enable those operations. And once you start that and you find you're only moderately successful, then you are in danger of being pulled further and further in. Your first wave may go 5 kilometres, but then do you need to go 10 or 20 or 200 kilometres, which is where some of the missiles will still be. So there is this really hard choice now. Do you announce victory and stop because you've culminated, or are you tempted to press on? If you press on, then we're going to come back to, we need to be certain about, were those missiles fired at Diego Garcia? Because previously we thought Iran's missiles had a range of 2,000 kilometres, and Diego is 3,800 kilometres from Iran.
So it would prove that they were dramatically more capable than we realised. We are putting in calls as we speak, General Sir Richard Barons, on that, to try and find out what the Ministry of Defence and others can tell us about those claims coming from the Iranian news media. But thank you for your time. Thank you to John McDonnell.
It's 20 past eight. Alan Bennett's latest volume of diaries is out this week, covering 8 years from 2016, in which he records his contemporaneous thoughts on Brexit, the death of Queen Elizabeth II, and the pandemic. A tumultuous period. Alan Bennett is now 91, and he's entitled the volume, rather poignantly, Enough Said. Our special correspondent, James Naughtie, has been talking to him.
Enough said. But Alan Bennett is still writing his diary at 91. A little more frail these days, but alert as ever. That pixie smile and schoolboy scamp haircut still there, so that he remains unmistakably the figure that first became so familiar to everyone who experienced the 60s, a time to which he often returns in conversation. And then through so much rich work over the subsequent decades, in print, on screen, and on the stage. I've been talking to him at home in London, with his partner Rupert alongside him. And it was inevitable that pretty soon we'd be talking about Yorkshire and his recent film script for The Choral, about the life of a northern town's choral society, its life and loves, its music and Elgar. In a sense, his England.
I wrote The Choral during COVID because I can't really get about. We didn't go to the shooting, which is the first time of anything that I've done. We weren't really hands-on with it.
Of course, many of the things you've written come up again and again, the history of boys, a question of attribution, an Englishman abroad. But 40 years on, in which John Gielgud played the key part originally, that play seems to have stayed with you in a remarkable way.
Yes, well, it was very happy. I felt, for some reason, I was emancipated doing it. I'd been slightly enthralled to other people, and now I was my own master, I think.
It's hard to read these diaries without feeling that sense of loss throughout, and yet a feeling for what remains. It's what you want to hold on to, whether it's the Yorkshire Dales, whether it's friends, whether it's books, when you took all the books out of your old house just round the corner from here.
I was opposite Jonathan Miller, which was a bit of a mixed blessing, because he was always knocking at the door.
There are more boring people who could have been knocking on the door. That's not bad. He died in the course of these diaries. You had known him for more than 60 years, going back to Beyond the Fringe in 1960. You were very, very close, and yet there's something extraordinary in the diaries where you say that he never went to your plays and you never went to any of his opera productions. I found it extraordinary.
Right. He behaved better than I did. I mean, when I had the History Boys on at the National, he set off to go and then on Waterloo Bridge got out of the taxi in a fury and didn't go at all.
There must have been a sense with your great rise to fame, popularity in the 60s. In a way, you had to get away and be your own man, didn't you?
Yes. I just thought I could do comedy and that was all I could do. But partly through beginning to work with Nick Heitner, I found I could do other things, as, for instance, The Madness of George III.
When you wrote about The Madness of the King, somebody told me that you just took the manuscript when you'd finished it, cycled round to Nick Heitner's house, stuck it through the letterbox with a little note on it saying, "Is this crap?" And he decided no, that it wasn't.
That's absolutely true. It's not mock modesty. I just...
You didn't know?
Didn't know, really.
Well, he knew quite quickly.
He knew, yes. There were two great meetings in my life. One was with him, the other was with Rupert here.
He was with us here.
Yeah.
In the late 90s, Rupert, wasn't that?
Virtually the same time, really.
Yes, yeah.
You're now in your 90s. Friends go at this stage in anyone's life. They disappear. Jonathan Miller clearly being one. One of the other characters, and she became very close to you for reasons people will understand if they think of the lady in the van, Miss Shepherd, who lived outside your house round the corner from us here for so long. When Maggie Smith played that part on stage and on the screen, and she became very close to you.
Yes, I miss her now all the time. She could make you laugh and cry almost in the same sentence. It was always there, the sadness as well as the jokes.
You write in the diary about the day after Brexit, feeling like it must have felt in around the time of the Munich agreements, that half the country thought it was a good thing and the other half thought it was a terribly bad thing.
Yeah, and we still aren't through that, really. I mean, it seems to me we still haven't really turned our backs on Brexit.
The death of the Queen is obviously one of the prime events, public events, in this period of your diaries. And you've got terribly touching stories, which you've told in the diaries, about your father, who wasn't a demonstrative man, going out to see the young Princess Elizabeth coming to Leeds and taking off his trilby.
My dad suddenly took off his hat. And this was so unlike him. I mean, because it was a gesture and it was an acknowledgement of something that he'd never given any indication of caring about at all. It nearly made me cry. It was so upsetting. My parents were conservative with a small c, with a large c as well, but I'm not.
You're clearly not a conservative with a large c. Anybody looking when the index comes out of the diaries for Johnson B will find that it's not terribly complimentary.
The index is a place where you're allowed to let your hair down a bit.
You talk, I think, about the diary being as much about slowing down time as speeding it up, in the sense that it gives you a chance to make sense of things in a pattern, all these little random things that make up life, the mosaic of life.
I've written down some of the things that people say, particularly in Yorkshire. In the village, we have a communal shop, the centre of the village now. But I was in there one day, and there'd been a lot of lightning in London for some reason. And a woman came in and said, "Oh, I do like it when they have it nasty down south." And I thought, that's with that attitude, you're never going to get rid of the north-south divide.
Are you still writing the diary?
Yes.
You are. So, you see, at the end of this volume, you say, "Enough said."
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you, surely that's not the end, and you're confirming that it isn't.
Well, I don't see why I should stop. It's all I've got, really. I mean, I hope I can go on doing that.
So, enough said is not the end.
No, it's not.
It's the beginning of something else. Yeah. Alan Bennett, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, isn't that good news? We get more Alan Bennett talking there, of course, to Jim Nocte. Right, it is now, well, it's almost 8:30 on a Saturday morning. Time for the sport. Here's Simon.
Thanks, Nick. The League Cup final tomorrow brings together the Premier League's top two sides, Arsenal and Manchester City, at a fascinating moment in the season. Arsenal are chasing their first major trophy in almost 6 years. City, meanwhile, are looking for a lift. They were knocked out of the Champions League, of course, midweek, and perhaps a way to wrestle back some momentum in the title race. So let's bring in two former England internationals to look ahead to this one, the former Arsenal defender Lee Dixon. Good morning, Lee.
Morning, Simon. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. And the former Manchester City goalkeeper, David James. Morning, David.
Gone dying. Sorry, I'm in Iceland. <Arsenal. laughs> Go on, Dicker.
Right.
How are you, mate?
Focus, gents. Here we go. Lee, let's start with you. How significant is this moment for Arsenal? Not just a final, but a chance to end that wait for a major trophy.
Yeah, I mean, it's been time. They've been knocking on several doors over the last few years. And I think everybody connected to the club, the fans, the owners, the staff behind the scenes, they're all kind of waiting for the next moment that they can really show what they're up to. But I think they've done that up until now. I think this is the best squad we've seen from Mikel. They seem to have that belief when they've had a couple of wobbles in the league. We all jump on it and say, oh, they're going to do it again. But there seems to be a different edge to this Arsenal side right now. I do think the competition this season, on all fronts, maybe not the Champions League yet because we're getting right near to the pointed end of that, but certainly in the league hasn't come from the likes of Liverpool and Manchester City like we think. It's still not over by any means, but I think this is pivotal in the, you know, everyone's talking about the quadruple. I'm always a big believer in the next big trophy is the next one to concentrate on, and they've got a brilliant opportunity to really set a marker down at City's feet at the moment.
Mikel Arteta has been talking about attacking the final. What does that actually mean?
Well, I think in the past when he's had these big crunch games, certainly in the league against City and over time, he's kind of, I always think he's a bit too respectful with Pep. You know, he's his mate and he's worked underneath him. He's got massive respect for each other. But I think sometimes he's not quite got that belief that he can go toe-to-toe with them. And so he always plays a little bit more defensive, a little bit more cautious. And everybody's been, you know, shouting for the handbrake to be off. And I think this is one of those occasions where they are defensively a lot better than City. And if they just use that as a base rather than their main game plan, I think, and you know, play the game from that position, I think they'll win the game. I do. I'm really confident that they'll win it. Mm-hmm. But I think he has got to be positive, really positive in it.
Okay. David, the mood around Manchester City has been described as unusually flat. To what degree would a win reset things psychologically, do you think?
Yeah, I'm not surprised, especially after what happened in the Champions League. I think this is interesting. And listening to Lee there, I think in the past, what you've had with Arteta going into these finals is kind of like the be-all and end-all of the season. But that quadruple is very much alive, and losing on Sunday won't stop them from still being successful. I think with City, the manner in which they went out of the Champions League obviously will hurt. The form of Erling Haaland, of course, which has to be mentioned, has to be a concern given... what is it now, 2-3 months since he's shown any kind of usual consistency. So a win on Sunday, I think, first of all, it's a trophy, which is major. But then it will give them, hopefully, the belief that they can claw back the gap in the Premier League, which at the moment seems a little bit far.
Do you think, David, this feels a bit more than a cup final? Could it be like a hinge moment between two eras?
It's a moment in time, and I think, I think it's a moment in time. I mean, what Mikel has done over a number of years now has been able to get him into this position. The fear would be, I think, for City, talking about that hinge moment, or even for everyone in English football, I would argue, is that this is a start of something bigger and long term, rather than it just being sort of one peaking in a spell for Mikel. But again, that sounds a little bit cliched now, doesn't it? If City turn up, we know that they're more than capable of winning the game, and then that hinge moment might have to wait a couple of weeks.
Well, we'll wait and see. David, Lee, thank you very much for joining us on the Today programme this morning. Enjoy the final.
Thank you, Simon. This morning at 9 here on Radio 4, it's Saturday Live, and Adrian Charles is here to tell us what's coming up.
A very good morning to you. Today we have a TV legend with us, a man whose work is much more famous than him. He's incredibly modest with it. It was John Lloyd. He's a genius, really, behind all kinds of national institutions, Spitting Image, QI, Blackadder, the list goes on. A really fascinating man. Also fascinating, Kolasubha Swamy. A woman who got into punk into middle age, I think it's fair to say, and she helped others start punk bands too in the Leicester area. And there's a big booming middle-aged women's often punk scene in Leicester, and we're celebrating that. We're also celebrating the remarkable achievements of one Jazz Turner, who has a terminal diagnosis. She's become increasingly disabled, uses a wheelchair, but she's sailed solo around the British Isles, and now she's taking on the whole world, so I can't wait to speak to her. We'll also get the inheritance tracks of Dr. Sian Williams.
Adrian, thanks very much indeed. Quick look at the weather now. Today's going to see areas of mist and fog, slow to clear in the morning, leaving sunny spells and variable cloud for most.
It's 25 to 9. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Henry Zeffman. And here with a summary of the news, Lisa Costello.
A news agency linked to the Iranian government says Tehran has fired two missiles at the joint UK-US military base Diego Garcia in the Chagos Islands. Reports suggest they didn't hit the base. The government hasn't confirmed the claims. Yesterday, the Prime Minister agreed to let the US use British bases to target sites from which Iran is attacking the Strait of Hormuz. The former Director of Operations for the British Armed Forces, General Sir Richard Barons, told us that the UK's interests have been put at risk and ignoring Iran was no longer appropriate. But speaking on this programme, the Labour MP John McDonnell said the UK did not have to follow President Trump. Negotiators from Kiev and Washington are due to meet in the US later to discuss how to end Russia's war with Ukraine. Talks have been on hold since the US and Israel launched attacks on Iran. Politicians in the US are calling on the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, to give evidence about what she knows about the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Her representatives declined to comment. There's no legal mechanism to compel her to testify in the US.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. It's now 23 minutes to nine. She was for millions quite simply the voice of women, the voice of their interests, their concerns, their passions. For more than three decades, Jenny Murray was Woman's Hour, a job, a calling, which she took up after launching the Saturday edition of another noteworthy programme.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Jenny Murray and Peter Hobday.
Good morning and welcome to Woman's Hour. Good morning, pull up your stockings and watch out for compo. Good morning. So happily the world didn't end at 8:30 this morning when the Large Hadron Collider was switched on.
That voice, that warmth. 33 years she was presenter of Woman's Hour. And Jenny, during that time, had many memorable interviews with figures ranging from Betty Davis to Margaret Thatcher.
I was usually asked by a woman journalist, what's it like to be a woman prime minister? And I usually replied, as I said in the book, I have no idea because I've never experienced the alternative. To me, I was prime minister with a job to do and I was intent on doing the job.
But did you set out, I wonder, ever, to make these men who were perhaps beginning to disagree with you afraid? There is a somewhat ludicrous picture in the memoirs of Geoffrey Howe, Nigel Lawson, the whole gang of them at the end, sort of feeding each other's courage to face you. Did you try to frighten them?
How absolutely absurd.
Jenny, Dame Jenny, as she would later become, spoke openly with her listeners about certain aspects of her own personal life, her weight loss surgery, her experience of the menopause. And 20 years ago, she announced live on air she'd been diagnosed with breast cancer.
I'll be having treatment in the coming weeks. The prognosis, by the way, is excellent, and I plan to be back as soon as I feel up to it.
Dame Jenny Murray, well, to reflect on her life and her work, we're joined by a woman who was her editor for many years, Sally Feldman, former editor of BBC Woman's Hour, and joining us in the studio, Labour's former deputy leader, but someone who campaigned for really all of her life for women and women's issues, particularly in politics, Harriet Harman, who's now co-host of the podcast Electoral Dysfunction and was a guest on Jenny Murray's final programme in 2020. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sally, first of all, your reflections about Jenny on this sad day.
It was quite a shock to hear those clips and to hear her voice, because it was so Jenny and so impossible to think she's not here with us. But great to hear all that, and good to hear Jenny talking about breast cancer, because it was so very important to her and so typical of her. She always identified with the audience. She loved the audience and felt she was asking questions for the women who hung on to her. And so it seemed right for her to let them know that she had breast cancer. She was honest. She felt they should know. And most of all, she wanted other women to feel this is something you can get through. She always valued more than anything letters that would come to us. And particularly on this subject, I thought I was alone. And then I heard about it on Woman's Hour. So I think she did a fantastic, it was a great, fantastic gesture on her part. And it really meant a great deal to so many women.
We're going to hear from Harriet in a second, the significance of Jenny Murray for the women's movement. Did she have, in the early days, Sally, of Woman's Hour, a sense of what you were doing and the importance of it?
I think we were very conscious of it. The two editors at the time, Claire Sillery, and at first I was her deputy, we'd been producers there for a long time, and we were anxious for change. We wanted to reflect what was happening in the world then. Woman's Hour, and then when Jenny arrived, became much more conscious of being a programme that spoke to women in a feminist way. We eventually had a policy called Twin Peaks, which meant the Twin Peaks of Woman's Hour was matters that have concern to women and matters concerned to the world from a woman's perspective. And that's what we did. And Jenny was brilliant at it.
A great description. Dame Harriet, broadcasting from a feminist point of view, it was a dramatic shift, wasn't it, in what we'd got used to on radio?
Well, it was. I mean, first off, my sympathies to Jenny Murray's family. I think it is impossible to overstate the importance of Jenny Murray and Woman's Hour to that movement of women. Sorry,
no,
I've got a frog in my throat, which was challenging the status quo. I mean, broadcasting was male-dominated, as was every other aspect of public life. And women were not satisfied with their role just being in the home. They wanted to be out and doing things in the wider world, in the public domain. And Woman's Hour and Jenny Murray understood that and were along with and ahead of the wave. So, for example, at the time, the Today programme would not be discussing issues of concern to women, whether it was maternity leave or childcare or domestic violence or just what women were doing as scientists or artists. And in a way, Jenny Murray in Woman's Hour was like the Today programme for women, and recognised their aspirations. And whether it was women scientists or women in business, you could hear women talking about their lives in a way that they were excluded from the mainstream male-dominated broadcasting.
What's intriguing, and in a sense you heard it in the clips, didn't you, and you heard in that description of Sally's about the Twin Peaks, was how she was able to combine what was sometimes derided as kind of soft features with that razor-sharp interviewing. I mean, it was quite waspish at times. I think you suffered once or twice, didn't you?
Yeah, she didn't give anybody an easy ride. Because she was alongside the women's movement didn't mean she wasn't a very sharp interrogator. You know, she was an interviewer and a broadcaster. But she could see the way things were going and was understanding that movement in women's lives, which was completely misunderstood by the rest of the broadcasting status quo. I mean, if you think about it, Parliament at that time, when she began on Woman's Hour, was only 6% women, and there was no women High Court judges, but things were changing. So she was talking to the women and about the women and with the women who were going to actually change politics, home life, the economy, society, and she also did it on foreign affairs as well. But she did. She was the science correspondent, the arts correspondent, the foreign correspondent, the political editor. She did everything on Woman's Hour that whole teams of things of men did on the mainstream programmes.
I don't think Jenny would forgive me if I didn't ask you a question I think she would ask, which is, at the end of her life, she felt abandoned by many people in the women's movement. Her views on trans meant that she felt shunned by the BBC. She felt shunned by many people in the women's movement at the very time that she felt that people should stand up for women's rights. Do you think, looking back, she had a point?
Well, I think, you know, there was a big controversy about trans issues, and certainly she was engaged as a protagonist in that. But I don't think that that takes away from the decades of change that she had a unique and really important position in.
Sally Feldman, a last thought from you, perhaps a memory of what it was like to work with Dame Jenny.
Jenny was funny. She was very astute, as Harriet said, and she was highly political. But she had enormous warmth. And what I remember is her probably favourite interview of all time, which was with her beloved Joan Baez. And I can remember Joan Baez telling the story on air about having to sing to Martin Luther King because he was tired and he was asleep and they needed him. So they said, "You must sing to him." And she sang what she sang to Jenny. And he woke up and said, "I think an angel was singing to me." Jenny, of course, burst into tears.
Sally Feldman, former editor of BBC Woman's Hour, Dame Harriet Allaman, thank you very much indeed for reflecting on the life of Dame Jenny Murray.
It's 9:15. For 3 weeks now, British politics has been the politics of war. Almost every major challenge facing Sir Keir Starmer's government has been aggravated, in some cases utterly transformed, by the US-Israeli strikes on Iran and the havoc wreaked across the Gulf by Iran's response. The US approach, again, is somewhat unclear this morning. In a post on his Truth Social platform last night, President Trump appeared to suggest he might be preparing to wind down the operation. Other reports suggest a possible ground invasion is being prepared. But if this is a prolonged conflict, the implications for the British economy could be severe. Fuel prices are still surging. The cost of government borrowing yesterday hit its highest level since 2008, a reflection of investors' concerns that the UK is staring at an inflation shock. On the diplomatic side, the president continues to publicly disdain Sir Keir, who for so long was determined to forge as warm a relationship with his counterpart as possible, even accounting for their somewhat different temperaments. Well, who better to join me and Nick to talk through where all of this leaves Britain than Lord Gove, Michael Gove, the editor of The Spectator. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Rachel Sylvester, political editor of The Observer. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
We'll start with you, Michael, because you have sat around these tables. Is this one of those moments, like COVID or like the period of inflation which followed the full scale of invasion of Ukraine by Russia, where at those cabinet meetings, those COBRA emergency committees, you think, gosh, everything is about to change here?
Yes, and I think that will be felt particularly acutely in the Treasury and by Rachel Reeves. It's been the case in the past that there have been interventions by the United States which have required Britain to play a supportive role, and there's been a debate around the cabinet table about exactly how forward to be. But I don't think there's been any foreign intervention precipitated by America which has quite the impact that this has on oil prices, energy prices, and, as you say, inflation. We know that there's already been an intervention to help people who rely on, who are essentially off-grid, in order to help them with energy prices. And we know that there's consideration being given to helping people at the lower end of the income scale. We had that with Liz Truss when she was Prime Minister during that brief less than 50-day period. And there are all sorts of discussions about why Liz Truss suffered as she did and fell. But undeniably, one of the factors was the scale of the intervention that she was responsible for at that time to deal with fuel prices, all because of Ukraine.
A scale of intervention which, certainly I know from conversations I've had with people in Westminster, the government does not believe it can or indeed perhaps should replicate. I mean, Rachel, the government said at the start of the year they wanted to focus relentlessly on the cost of living. They've got their wish, not quite in the way that they might have hoped. How worried do you think they are at the top of government?
I think very worried. And, you know, Keir Starmer's been saying for months, hasn't he, that foreign affairs affect British voters and consumers. And you can see that so vividly now with those oil fields and gas fields on fire across the Middle East. And for the government, in the end, politics comes down to, do you feel better than you did at the last election when people go to the polls? And this makes it much harder for them to make the voters feel better when they go to vote next time. And I think they are looking very seriously at targeted measures. As Michael says, they're not going to do the sort of £44 billion intervention that Liz Truss did, which gave a universal support to people with their energy bills. But there is an awareness that people are suffering and are going to suffer. And it's not just energy bills, though, is it? It's mortgage rates. It's general inflation. The Treasury rule of thumb is that for every 20% that energy prices go up, inflation rises by 1% and growth reduces by 0.5%. So this is also about what the government can spend on the public services. Are they going to have to put up taxes?
And that raises a bigger question. Does this trigger a major rethink? Do you say, if you're on the left, forget the fiscal rules, we can actually go to the markets and say the world has changed and therefore we're changing our approach, we can borrow a lot more? Or indeed, do you say all those things that we promised we wouldn't change, the triple lock, for example, vastly expensive, and if you removed it over time, would give some reassurance to the markets? Is anybody, Michael, in politics, do you think, in the cabinet or beyond, willing to say, let's just think again?
Well, we know that Lisa Nandy, the culture secretary, who's one of the voices of the soft left within Labour, has suggested that perhaps some of the fiscal discipline that Labour has stuck to so far be relaxed. We had Andy Burnham, the mayor of Greater Manchester in the past, making this case. The problem is that the fiscal strength of Britain has been weakened, etiolated over time, not just because of decisions that this government has made, but also because of Ukraine, COVID, and so on. So our capacity to say, hey, we're a front-rank economy, we should be able to borrow more at a time of crisis, has been winnowed away over time. So that's why Rachel Reeves is very cautious, exactly as Rachel says, about doing anything other than, not minimalist, but targeted interventions. But again, as Rachel indicated, it's not just the fuel prices that we face as domestic energy users. The oil and gas shock has an impact on interest rates, inflation overall, everything from, as you were discussing earlier, the cost of fertilizers and the impact on food to other areas in the economy. So one area also that will come under strain and will be difficult for Labour is there'll be a growing drumbeat of demand for reversing the position on oil and gas in the North Sea that Ed Miliband has taken.
We'll come on to that, Michael, because you wrote a very provocative column in The Spectator this week saying that Ed Miliband is, in fact, now the Prime Minister. We'll come back to that. But just on this point about borrowing, Rachel, because I think there's an important thing here. We had a lot of conversation in Westminster that sort of bubbled away again in the past few weeks about student loans and about what that says about intergenerational fairness. Let's just be clear, when we're talking about the government borrowing money to alleviate the costs for people here, they are talking about future taxpayers or current taxpayers at a later date paying that back. To what extent do you think the government fears that some of these issues here might exacerbate those intergenerational issues for generations who've really never really known economic growth in this country?
I think that is an issue. And there's also going to be a question about, if you do targeted support, what's the cutoff point? And everybody who's below that cutoff point is going to be cross. And so these are very difficult decisions. But I think you're absolutely right, Henry. There is a question, particularly about the triple lock, which is costing billions and billions of pounds. And is just absolutely unsustainable. And I think also it's about, if you've got to find the money, where do you find it from and who pays for it? And there are going to be questions about that.
Which is why I raised the question with you, Michael, as to whether anybody be bold on this. Because what's been striking is so-called populist politicians on left and right have competed to promise to spend more, not less, even on the right. Now, Kemi Badenoch sort of stepped very gently towards sounding as if she wanted a smaller state and then backed off when it came to the triple lock. Is this a moment of boldness for someone?
It may well be. So John Bew, who has been foreign policy advisor to four prime ministers, including Keir Starmer and his three Conservative predecessors, wrote in the New Statesman last week outlining what might be required at a time like this. And he made it clear that we'd need to have a change on energy policy, but we would also need to reduce spending on welfare and on the NHS. And John Bew, as it were, is a hard centrist. There is a view shared by some within Labour, and I don't know if there are any Conservatives who share this view, that in order actually to achieve what is required for the economic reconstruction of this country and to face down the opposition, both on spending but also in areas like land use planning as well, you actually need a hard centre government. You need effectively the right of Labour and pro-business Conservatives to get behind these measures. Now,
are you calling for a national coalition?
Well, for people in Labour, this will be an uncomfortable echo of what happened in 1929 to 1931.
Maybe led from the House of Lords.
When Ramsay MacDonald, the Labour Prime Minister, facing an international crisis, again, coming from America, an economic one, not a foreign policy one, eventually recognised that a national government was required.
Sure, that was your moment to say, should the ball come from the back of the
strut? It's been there, done that, Nick. Yeah. I mean, in terms of the leadership of probably not of a national government, but of a Labour government, I mean, one of the things that has been striking about these past 3 weeks is that question of the leadership had been suppressed. So Keir Starmer has felt comfortable, hasn't he, Rachel, on the international stage? I thought this Monday when he gave a press conference in the morning, he looked really quite confident. And then along came Angela Rayner, his former deputy, questioning a crucial plank of his immigration policy, questioning the government's strategy generally. Rachel, what's she up to?
Well, those questions don't go away, and Angela Rayner's people are very keen to stress that there's no sort of leadership challenge in the offing, although I'm sure if Wes Streeting were to mount one, then she'd quickly come up again. But I think what one Labour MP was saying to me this week, that Donald Trump has saved Keir Starmer for the moment at least, and I think it would be pretty difficult for a challenger if the current crisis continues, even after May and Labour does terribly in those local and elections, to try and topple Keir Starmer, because it would just look so self-indulgent.
But the same thing applied, of course, with Ukraine and Boris. Rachel is absolutely right that Keir Starmer's position is stronger within the Labour Party and the Labour movement because his, not pro-Trump, but his statesmanlike approach towards America was uncomfortable for many in Labour. Now this conflict has united people and the war atmosphere has united people in Labour to a significant extent behind Starmer. But the Ukraine war, while it might have sustained Boris's period at number 10, didn't save him.
Yeah. I mean, sustained him for 4 months or something like that, and then along came Liz Truss.
Yes.
Starmer has ruthlessly exploited what he thinks is the confusion in Kemi Badenoch's position, and indeed that she's on the wrong side of public opinion. It's true, isn't it? In your ranks, in the Lords and in the Commons, there are quite a lot of people muttering in private saying, what are we saying here? 1 minute before the war, 1 minute against the war, not really clear.
I think that the whole area has become so turbid because we've seen Keir Starmer himself change his stance, and it's perfectly defensible in its own terms, from one of declining to allow America to use bases to endorsing the American use of bases. The theoretical experts in international law can explain exactly why this is coherent, but for the public, what they see is one party that was cautious becoming more forward, and they've also seen the Tories and Reform, which were more forward, becoming more cautious. So again, Starmer at Prime Minister's Question Time last week, I think, was quite effective in doing so. This week, it had a slightly jejune air when he did it.
But what we do have, Rachel, don't we, is something we didn't have in the immediate aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, or actually, I think, for the first few months after October the 7th, 2023, which is a divide in British politics over foreign policy. Do you think that is now, contrary to one of those aphorisms, no one votes on foreign policy, do you think that is now, in fact, one of the key battlegrounds in British politics?
I think the thing that's really interesting is you've had a Prime Minister who stood up and said no to an American president over that initial request to use bases for offensive airstrikes. And, you know, the FDR phrase, judge me by my enemies, every time Donald Trump attacks Keir Starmer, his reputation is enhanced among the voters. And I think that's one reason why he's stronger, is because he's defined himself. He now has definition against a deeply unpopular American president.
Quick chance for a word then about where it leaves the two successful leaders on left and right. Nigel Farage, does he pay a heavy price for being, as it were, Donald Trump's friend, Michael?
No, I don't think so. I think what's hurting him more at the moment is the loss of salience of migration and the increased salience of the economy.
And Zach Polanski, clearly wants to be the leader, in a sense, of the anti-war movement. Will he benefit from that?
I think his danger is he looks extreme, particularly if he sticks to this anti-NATO position. And he's got to moderate himself to be able to appeal to a wider range of voters.
And I guess we should also say that Sir Ed Davey of the Liberal Democrats would say that he was first to say that Sir Keir Starmer should not be taking the approach to Donald Trump that he was.
When we allow you to leave the studio and go back to the day job,